Good afternoon. I will call the meeting of the subcommittee to order. I want to remind folks that we're not going to be voting on anything here today. You all should have a copy of the agenda, and if not, the purpose of this meeting, again, is to update the EQB Silica Sand Subcommittee on the status of the multi-agency rulemaking on silica sand. The agencies have concluded the year-long process of working with Silica Sand Rulemaking Advisory Panel to get input on the subject of rules and are moving into completing draft rule language and writing statement of need of reasonable SONRs to support the rules as they are proposed. This meeting will includes a listening session for the public to provide input and obviously comments on the draft rules as last shared with the advisory panel. I want to also remind those that wish to testify to please put your name on one of these cards and make sure that you pass those up to the front, and so we can call on you at the appropriate time. With that, let's zip around the board for introductions. Julie?
Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
Kristen Ivy Tollefson, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Tom Landwehr, commissioner of DNR.
John Sachs-Haug, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Dave Fredrickson, commissioner of agriculture and chair of the EQB board.
Will Seifert, director of the EQB.
Eric Tomlinson, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
And Bill Sirks, I'm sitting in for the Commissioner Stein of the MPCA today, and I'm a manager at the PCA.
Bill, and thanks very much for coming. With that, I'll throw it over to Executive Director Will Seifert for some comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be really brief since a number of folks have traveled a long way to make some comments today. First off, I just want to note that Kate Knuth and John Sachs-Haug had their confirmation hearings yesterday. They went very well, and so they should be moving to the floor for a full vote here pretty soon. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Our budget, just a note on our budget, the budget process is moving forward at the legislature right now, and today the House is considering a budget bill that would reduce the EQB's technical assistance account in half. And so in your packet, you should have a letter that the board chair had sent to the chairman of the committee. And I made comments on the record similar to that, but I just wanted to call your attention to that, is that that will be something that we're working with the legislature to resolve by the end of session. A couple notes on the rulemaking. You know, having a multi-agency rulemaking panel was a unique endeavor. The purpose was to really try and break out of the traditional silos and make it easy for the public, local government, and industry to efficiently participate in the process. I want to acknowledge the hard work of the 15 panelists and their alternates. This was a large time commitment, and we appreciate your contributions to the discussion. Many of these individuals are not paid and have made personal sacrifices to participate. Thank you for your service. I also want to acknowledge the hard work of the agency staff and MMB for facilitating these meetings. As a reminder for the subcommittee, you're going to hear about three rules today, but only one of them will come to the board for full approval, and that's the environmental review rule that Eric will present later, and that will be over the summer. So with that.
We've been joined by one more member. Ed, I'd like to ask you to introduce yourself to the crowd.
Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health.
Thank you for being here. With that, we will go directly to item number two on the agenda, and that is the briefing on the wrap-up and final meetings of the Silica Sand Rulemaking Advisory Panel. And welcome Eric Dahl from the EQB staff. Eric?
Thank you, Commissioner Fredrickson. Members, I think we have a technical glitch here. We don't have any videos showing
really?
The presentation.
I hadn't noticed that there are no videos up there. Thank you for pointing that out. So we have all these tech reps in the room, you know, and nobody's stepping up. What's going on here?
It's almost like a switch isn't on or something. It's something really simple. Let's see.
Well, this is going to be a problem if we don't have.
Yeah.
So
I can see it here, but we could all crowd around.
Right? Yeah. Where is? Okay.
Sorry for the delay.
No, that's all right. Why don't we do this? We'll just stand in recess for a few minutes until we get some assistance in getting this resolved. So talk among yourself. And Ed can have his banana, yeah.
No, it's, Mr. Chair, what I have, a candy bar I got.
That's right.
Besides, for not bringing candy bars for everybody. Well, and I see you're not selling the same criticism to Dr. Ehlinger.
Children, you're supposed to bring enough for everyone. Yes. Well,
I'm bruised.
Spring-loaded trap mine there. You remember that when I gave you a little tough time 4 years ago about eating a candy bar in front of everyone?
It was right
to the heart. I chastised innocent children. You know, if you're going to bring candy, bring some for everyone.
And the next time?
Bring it in the next year. I think you may have.
Thank you for remembering, John.
I remember things like that. I don't remember anything else.
I don't remember what kind of candy.
No, I don't either. It was
the B class candy.
I know, it was probably Halloween candy.
Totally.
It's like the power went out.
Candy from 3 years ago, right?
He found it out in the garage.
I'll still eat it.
Like a power issue. Like there must just be a switch that somebody forgot.
He's going to go flip a switch on the wall. Already.
That's kind of what it seems like should happen. Maybe it's a fuse.
30 seconds.
Yeah.
Nope, not that.
Whoa.
It's hard to come in on a day like this. If I was retired, I wouldn't come in and call it sick.
I was listening.
We have the mic now. Okay. Do we have it everywhere?
I will bring the meeting back to order. And sorry, Eric, but your time is.
Good afternoon, Chair Fredrickson and EQB members. I'm Eric Cederleaf-Dahl, a principal planner at EQB. I've been working on the silica sand issue for over a year and a half now, and I understand how important these rules are to the people of Minnesota. Today, the EQB, Pollution Control Agency, and Department of Natural Resources will update the silica sand subcommittee on the silica sand rule advisory panel process, the rulemaking process, and preliminary draft rules. As you know, during the 2013 legislative session, three agencies were directed to make rules for the regulation of silica sand projects. MPCA rules to control particulate air pollution emissions, DNR to develop rules to set standards for mine reclamation, and EQB to develop rules to determine what types of projects should undergo environmental review. This is prevents a very simplified overview of the rules process. We are currently here. One thing to emphasize here is that although this is only one box on the chart, rule development and the development of the Statement of Need and Reasonableness, the SONAR, is the longest and most important part of the rulemaking. This is where each agency develops a rule and works with stakeholders to get input. In addition, one of the reasons that the rule process is so complex is that it is designed to ensure that the public has multiple chances to weigh in on the rule. At these points, you'll see the EQB approval moving there as well, both at the very initiation of rulemaking and later in the process, through comment periods and a hearing in front of an administrative law judge. Now that the advisory panel is complete, each agency will continue refining rule language and continue to develop their SONAR and will then move through the official rulemaking process. You'll hear more on that from each agency. As we approach the beginning of the rulemaking process, the agencies determined that we wanted to work together as much as possible. Although we each make rules within our own distinct authorities, we know that the whole picture of the regulation of this industry is an important consideration for each rule. Most importantly, EQB Board directed that a joint rule advisory panel be convened. The intent of the Silica Sand Advisory Panel was to provide an avenue to effectively and efficiently interact with and advise the state on silica sand rulemakings. The agencies worked together during the panel and are continuing to work closely together in discussing each rulemaking and developing definitions that work well together. Under Minnesota's rulemaking process, an agency can have such a panel to comment on the subject matter of a possible rulemaking. This is the first time multiple agencies have been involved in a rule advisory panel. The panel is made up of 15 members, divided between representatives of local government, industry, and citizens. The panel met from January 2014 to February 2015, 13 times. There were great discussions and spirited disagreement on each rulemaking throughout the panel process. Now I'd like to take a moment and recognize the huge commitment that the Silica Sand panel was for participants, especially citizens. Thank you. The panel was incredibly important to the rule development process. Now I'm going to pause for a moment and just thank you, those that are here today. Thank you very much for coming.
Could they stand? The ones?
Those that were a part of the panel, or could you please stand?
Oh, great.
All right, now I'm going to move into my specific presentation for EQB. Chair Frederickson, members, now I'll put on my rule writer hat, and I'll begin by discussing EQB's preliminary draft rules for environmental review for silica sand projects. You'll hear from the MPCA and DNR after my presentation, but it's important to note that the EQB environmental review rules are the only rules the EQB board will vote to approve at a future meeting. I'll begin today by giving a background on legislation, environmental review, and the current interim rule. Then I'll discuss EQB's rulemaking process, and then I'll go through the preliminary draft rules, first the EAW, then the EIS. Then I'll discuss EQB's next steps, and then the PCA and DNR will make their presentations. During the 2013 legislative session, EQB was directed to develop rules to determine what types of silica sand projects should undergo environmental review. The Environmental Quality Board shall amend its rules for environmental review adopted under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 116D for silica sand mining and processing to take into account the increased activity in the state and concerns over the size of specific operations. The EQB shall consider whether the requirements of Minnesota Statutes Section 116C.991 should remain part of the environmental review requirements for silica sand and whether the requirements should be different for different geographic areas of the state. So just to take a step back on, and remind the board and the public what environmental review is. Environmental review is intended to be used as a source of information for the public and a guide for regulatory decisions. Environmental review is a process that helps government decision makers understand environmental impacts of a project, make information available to governments, citizens, and proposers early in the decision-making process, designate responsible government unit, reduce delay and uncertainty in the process. Environmental review does not approve or deny projects. Within environmental review, there are mandatory categories as well as discretionary means for a project to undergo environmental review. This rulemaking is specific to establishing mandatory categories for silica sand projects that should be required to conduct environmental review. Now I'm going to go through the interim rule that the 2013 legislature gave EQB. Until July 1st, 2015, an environmental assessment worksheet must be prepared for any silica sand project that meets or exceeds the following thresholds. I'd also like to point out that you have a handout here that has the interim threshold on it, and that was available at the table over here for those in attendance. So you can follow along. So an environmental assessment worksheet must be prepared for any silica sand project that meets or exceeds the following thresholds. Excavates 20 or more acres of land to a mean depth of 10 feet or more during its existence. The local government is the responsible government unit. Or is designed to store or capable of storing more than 7,500 tons of silica sand or has an annual throughput of more than 200,000 tons of silica sand and is not required to receive a permit from the Pollution Control Agency. In this case, the Pollution Control Agency is the responsible government unit. The second portion of the EQB interim rules, these requirements are already included in the environmental assessment worksheet, and thus we will not be bringing these forward as part of this rule. As part of the rulemaking process, in addition to the year-long silica sand rule advisory panel, EQB staff published a request for comments in July 2013. EQB staff visited 18 LGUs and visited silica sand projects in Minnesota and Wisconsin, held face-to-face meetings with stakeholders, and conducted an online survey with LGUs about the draft rule, thresholds, and RGUs. Now a little on EQB rules. Environmental review thresholds in Minnesota Rules 4410 are based on three factors: the best available data and science, the historical context of silica sand projects in the state, the number, type, location, and size of silica sand projects, and stakeholder input from citizens, LGUs, industries, and agencies. The EQB rulemaking process strives to be an open, fair, and transparent process. Now I'm going to move. Now I'll present the preliminary draft rules. On the other side of this handout are the preliminary draft rules. And same for they were available on the table there, and the same handout here. This is the first. I'll go through the EAW, and then I'll go through the EIS. An environmental assessment worksheet must be prepared for any silica sand project that meets or exceeds the following thresholds. For development of a silica sand project for the extraction or mining of silica-rich sandstones that will result in 20 or more acres of mine area during the project's existence, the local government unit is the RGU. This rule language was derived from the 2013 interim rules. Both the threshold for extraction or mining of 20 acres of silica sand and the responsible government unit being the local government unit follow the 2013 legislation. Now I'll move on to the next one. An environmental assessment worksheet must be prepared for any silica sand project that meets or exceeds the following thresholds. For development of a silica sand facility where no mining is present, the PCA is the RGU for the following. A silica sand facility designed to produce an annual throughput of 200,000 tons or more of silica sand, or designed to store 7,500 tons or more of silica sand, or an expansion resulting in more than in a more than 50% increase in throughput of an existing silica sand facility designed to produce an annual throughput of 200,000 tons or more of silica sand. The silica sand facility, meaning the processing, storage, or transload aspect of the operation, rule language is also derived from the 2013 interim rules. Threshold numbers and the RGU remain the same as the 2013 legislation, with 200,000 tons of silica sand throughput and 7,500 tons of storage. After extensive discussions with the Silica Sand Rule Advisory Panel and stakeholders, an expansion threshold of 50% was added to the draft rule language. Now the next, an environmental assessment worksheet must be prepared for any silica sand project that meets or exceeds the following thresholds. For development of a silica sand project for the extraction or mining of silica-rich sandstone that requires a DNR trout stream setback permit and will result in 15 or more acres of mine area during the project's existence, the DNR is the RGU. This threshold is designed to track with a sensitive feature in the Paleozoic Plateau, the DNR trout stream setback permit. The threshold is 15 acres based on the stakeholder process and on the recommendation of DNR technical staff. The DNR is the RGU for this mandatory category. Now, the last EAW threshold. An environmental assessment worksheet must be prepared for any silica sand project that meets or exceeds the following thresholds. For development of a silica sand project for the extraction or mining of silica-rich sandstone that will result in 2 or more acres of mine area in a forested or other naturally vegetated land in a sensitive shoreland area, or 10 or more acres of mine area during its existence in a forested or other naturally vegetated land in a non-sensitive area, the local government is the RGU. Consistent with the previous slide for sensitive features, this threshold focuses on silica sand projects in sensitive and non-sensitive shoreland areas. Following Minnesota Rules 4410-4300 and 4410-4400 mandatory category rule precedent, the LGU is the RGU for this mandatory category. Now I'll move to EIS thresholds. An environmental impact statement must be prepared for any silica sand project that meets or exceeds the following thresholds. For development of a silica sand project for the extraction or mining of silica-rich sandstones that will result in 80 or more acres of mine area during the project's existence, the local government unit is the RGU. This is developed utilizing an extensive and thorough stakeholder process. The threshold of 80 acres is due to the projects having the potential for significant environmental effects. Just as the EAW mining category, the responsible government unit remains the LGU for this mandatory category. And then the last EIS threshold, excuse me. An environmental impact statement must be prepared for any silica sand project that meets or exceeds the following thresholds. For development of an underground silica sand mine, the local government unit is the RGU. Again, developed utilizing an extensive and thorough stakeholder process, due to the complexity of underground mines and the potential for significant environmental effects, all underground mines would be required to conduct an EIS, with the local government unit being the RGU. Now just back again to remind you about environmental review, that environmental review is intended to be used as a source of information for the public and a guide for regulatory decisions. Environmental review is a process that helps government decision makers understand the environmental impacts of a project, make information available to governments, citizens, and proposers early in the decision-making process, and designates the responsible government unit and helps reduce delay and uncertainty in the process. Environmental review does not approve or deny projects. Again, this rulemaking is focused on the mandatory category, establishing mandatory categories for silica sand projects that should be required to conduct environmental review. EQB's next steps will be to finalize proposed rule language and the statement of need and reasonableness, and then transition to official rulemaking in the summer of 2015. The EQB board will EQB staff will come before the EQB board for approval of rule language in the SONAR, and then we'll move into the official rulemaking process, where there will be numerous opportunities throughout the official process for public comment and interaction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Are there questions for Eric from members of the board? Eric?
Thank you.
got to get it right, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm curious, the interim rules had that subsection B that included additional study to be included in the EAW, and I'm curious what happened to that, or did that go away, and why did that go away?
Yes, thank you, Chair Fredrickson, members. So section B is already included in the environmental assessment worksheet, and it's not something that would go in the 4410 sections of EQB rules.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Eric.
Thank
we'll
you.
Move directly to Catherine Neuschler, and Catherine is going to present an update on MPCA air emissions rule. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board. My name is Catherine Neuschler. I'm the supervisor of the agency rules unit here at the Pollution Control Agency. So I'm just going to give an update on where we're at in our rules. As Eric noted previously, our legislative charge was to make rules pertaining to the control of particulate emissions, air pollution, from silica sand projects. And the prime reason for that is that particulate matter is an air pollution of concern for its adverse health impacts, primarily on cardiovascular and pulmonary effects, and also concerns about the silica that's in those particulates. Our first step in this rulemaking was to issue a request for comments, basically to announce that we had been directed to undertake the rulemaking and we were beginning the process and asking for early input from interested parties. The comment period on that was in 2013. It lasted for about 2 months, and we received more than 50 comments. The comments fell into sort of general themes, focusing around the stringency of the standards, ensuring that the MDH health-based value standard would be met, and public access to information about emissions from silica sand facilities. Many of the comments were general calls for the PCA to establish stringent standards and to ensure that all silica sand facilities met them. In general, there were also a lot of calls to make sure that every facility has an individual air permit, that there's monitoring of the levels of silica and particles in the ambient air, and that any violations of any standards have meaningful consequences, that there's insurance that facilities are complying and enforcement. Most of the comments received in response to this initial notice in 2013 did come from concerned citizens. Comments were also received from companies conducting silica sand mining and processing. And those comments generally indicated that the PCA should ensure that the rule was based on sufficient information about the impacts of the industry on air pollution, cited some preliminary studies in Wisconsin that showed silica levels in the air to be below levels of concern, and also expressing the view that much of the PCA's current air pollution rules and permitting regimes were sufficient to control air pollution. So that was kind of the general themes that we heard as we started on this process. And then, as Eric noted, in January of 2014, we began working with the Silica Sand Advisory Panel. Again, that panel was convened under the provisions of the Administrative Procedure Act that says that the state agency conducting a rulemaking can convene a panel to comment on the subject matter of the rule. So in working with that panel, we started with an overview, and the PCA presented kind of a rulemaking 101 to the panel to help them understand how Minnesota's admittedly complicated rulemaking procedures work. And then through the first couple of meetings, the agencies heard from the panelists that they wanted to really be sure that they had enough information about how our programs worked to be able to give good advice on the rules that each agency was considering. So our next step for the PCA, which was in February, was to give the group a 101 on air regulations and our air permitting program. One key part of this 101 is to understand that the rules for the MPCA's air program are fairly self-contained. We write the rules, we do the permits, and we enforce them. So unlike the EQB rule, where the state agency is writing the rule to be fulfilled by other agencies, we are writing rules that we ourselves will enforce, not a local government or another agency. And when we did that air regulation 101, we also did an interest exercise to just ask the panel, what are your interests around controlling air pollution and air regulations for this industry? In our next step, we prepared what we called a silica sand air rule concept document. And what we were trying to do with that was to just kind of lay out in plain language, not in rule format, but just sort of general principles about what the structure of our rule would be and what it would contain. And so at a very high level, that concept focused on requiring source-oriented monitoring, monitoring at the fence line or boundary of a facility designed to show that specific facility's contribution to overall air pollution levels, and then requirements to minimize the particulate emissions from specific processes that are conducted as part of silica sand mining and processing. And those range from, you know, numerical emission limits to operational practices and procedures that are designed to reduce emissions. After we discussed that concept document with the panel, we also decided to make it available more widely for public comment. So we published a second request for comments in the State Register in late September, with a comment period running until just before Thanksgiving. We got fewer comments this time, I think only 9, but they were very much more detailed. And they continue to illustrate the widely differing viewpoints that we saw from those likely to be affected by the rule. Again, there was a lot of discussion about permits. Some felt that individual air permits were needed for all facilities. Others felt that smaller sources did not need permits with such detailed requirements. Individual air emission permits require site-specific conditions that are tailored to the processes at the facility, and they also have public notice and comment procedures. So that's what these sort of additional things that happen when you get an individual air permit. Ambient air monitoring requirements to measure pollution at the boundary of a facility, continued to draw a really mixed response. Some parties were very supportive. Others felt it didn't go far enough, that smaller particles should be monitored. And still others felt that existing data about the air pollution really didn't show a need for air monitoring at all facilities, and that it should be considered on a case-by-case basis. Our proposed pollution control practices also received a mixed response. Some felt that the PCA hadn't demonstrated the need for the additional regulations, that appropriate regulation can be done through permitting rather than the need to detail things out in rule. The draft air rule concept discussed enclosure of certain kinds of processes, which was particularly controversial. And then finally, there were also comments about the need for aggressive enforcement of any conditions and also about when facilities would be expected to come into compliance. So again, we heard pretty similar themes carrying through our first two notices, very different, sort of different sides to each issue, but focusing on the same areas. Listening to those comments and taking them into account, and after some internal agency discussions, we revised some of the concepts and produced the draft rule language, which we distributed to the panel in November and has been the rule language that's been available since then and was in your packets today. The most major change we made between sort of our plain language concept and our draft rule was to move away from our initial structure, which set different requirements for new sources and sources that would be already in effect when the rule went into effect, or already in operation, excuse me, when the rule went into effect, and just extend the time frame for existing sources to come into compliance. Other than that, a lot of it stayed the same. So then what does the current draft of the rule say? At the most basic level, what we're intending the rule to do is to describe what kinds of silica sand facilities and what sizes of silica sand facilities need an individual air permit, and then include the minimum requirements for what must be in that permit, giving some certainty to both industry and to citizens as to how facilities will be regulated. Rule writing is an iterative process, and if you read the rule language when we were preparing for this meeting, we realized we might not have quite that part about the threshold of who's going to be covered. The language might not quite be there yet, so we're still working on it. We're still, in fact, considering the size threshold to trigger that requirement to get an individual permit. In discussions with the panel, we have proposed 200 tons per day of sand throughput, which, for context, is about 8 trucks or 2 rail cars. And under 1 barge. The draft rule also continues to include ambient air monitoring requirements, with the type and the amount of monitoring required dependent on the processes that are in operation at the facility. So it would be different for a facility that simply has sand storage versus one that's actually processing and moving. We've heard concerns about the monitoring, and we're working on data analysis and modeling to help us determine the appropriate approach. The modeling will also help us to come up with requirements for various processes once pollution control practices and equipment are applied. And I think since the concept document, we've streamlined the number of process requirements. The rules also include fugitive dust mitigation plans, which is to prevent the particles from becoming airborne off piles and roads, and requirements to clean and cover vehicles. Finally, we've also looked at some other operational practices, such as testing for noise to address noise concerns and to limiting certain operation during high wind events. We envision that new facilities will have to comply basically immediately, allowing some time, 180 days possibly, for startup and shakedown of operations to make sure everything's operating correctly, while existing facilities will need to come into compliance within a certain time period ranging between 1 and 3 years. Once a facility is required to comply, the MPCA has a robust compliance and enforcement program that we use to enforce permits and rules already, and so that compliance and enforcement isn't in this rule because it's existing authority and rules that we have to ensure that facilities are complying with our requirements. This time I'm just going to really briefly talk about what more detail about the comments that we've gotten on the draft rule, and you have, I think there was a 3-page handout that goes into a little more detail as well. You know, the rule's been out for about 5 months. We've received a lot of comments, both during panel meetings, after panel meetings, at other meetings, at emails from people who are interested, and I'm sure that we will hear more later. So the feedback we've been getting continues to be pretty wide-ranging in terms of its opinions. In terms of the need for the rules and who they should apply to, some stakeholders feel that the rules are largely unnecessary and overly burdensome, while others feel that they are very important in order to ensure standards are met and public health is protected. Some feel that our proposed threshold for defining what facilities are subject to the rule is far too low, catching too many small sources, while others feel that it's too high and doesn't adequately address enough sources. The divergent response continues as we move on to the air monitoring requirements. Again, we've heard that existing information shows that silica sand facilities will not violate any of our standards for air pollution in the air, and so the monitoring is excessive, particularly when compared to other industries with similar size or pollution levels, while others feel that this monitoring is critical and needs to be done well with the information made widely available to the public. In terms of standards and practices to control emissions from specific things that happen at the facility, although I think there's agreement that there are reasonable practices for things like controlling dust from haul roads, there are, again, differences as to whether controls are needed, what types of controls are practicable, again, particularly around enclosure of certain types of things, and how stringent the controls should be. Finally, there were some additional comments about the importance of ensuring compliance and enforcement, again, both in terms of the methods being used by the facilities and the MPCA's role. These comments sort of in this bucket don't quite show the opposition to each other as some of the other areas. They just kind of relate to different areas. Industry's comments tended to focus on the compliance tests that they would need to conduct on-site, while other groups focus more on the consequences of any non-compliance, that those should be strong. So I know that's a very, very quick overview, but we've been listening to and considering all these thoughts, and we will be continuing to listen to input as we move on to our next steps and into our formal comment period. At this time, we're working on finalizing our proposed rule language, which will likely take the next couple months, and then we'll need assistance from the reviser of statutes once she is done assisting all the legislators who are writing bills right now. Similarly to the timeline that Eric laid out, we will be working on the proposed rule in SONAR through the summer, and I anticipate, my best guess at this point is that we would publish our proposed rules and notice of hearing in September, potentially, with then a hearing later in the fall. And normally, if we go to a hearing, it takes us about 9 months after that hearing process to actually complete the rule because of the steps where we have to get the judge's report and evaluate that, any changes. So normally that's about a 9-month process. So sometime in 2016. More information about our rules can be found on the PCA website. It includes draft rules, and then I believe that 3-page comment document summary should be posted there as well. This is kind of the small core rule team, and we'd be happy to answer any questions if you guys have them.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Thank you very much, Catherine. At this time, are there questions for Catherine? Eric?
Mr. Chair, I guess it's kind of a general comment, and I'm sure, you know, the flow chart that was up there before in the rulemaking process, it looks like things will be, there are other opportunities for things to get caught. I just noticed in the definition section between the three rules, there's some discrepancies, and just to, you know.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and board members, that's actually something that we've been working on for a long time. The three agencies we've tossed those around and back and forth, the definitions a lot. We thought it was going to be a lot easier than it turned out to be, but we're working very collaboratively on that. We really have a goal of making sure the rules aren't talking to totally different people. So we want to make our definitions work together as much as we can.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair. John. Catherine, I guess this ties in a bit with what Eric said in terms of the document and that it applies and appeals and is understandable to a broad range of people. Mm-hmm. You mentioned during your presentation about a plain language document. What did that involve?
Catherine.
Mr. Chair and board members, it was about, I think it's actually posted on our website, so it was about a 12-page kind of, we think we'll have air monitoring and it would compose of this and we think there'll be, I mean, we were just trying to sort of put out our thoughts without having to put it in the legalese. You know, one of the things that we are trying to do in rules at the Pollution Control Agency is be a little more plain language. When Eric showed something that was one page, he's like, here's my one-page summary. I thought, oh, that would have been a good idea. So that's certainly something that we'll be talking about internally about how to make sure when we continue to present these rules that they're really understandable because air regulations are particularly complex.
Chair and Catherine, you mentioned that this really is a work in process, mm-hmm. but I guess I would emphasize that plain language appealing to a range of people because just not the technical people are going to be using
right.
that.
Yep. Thank you.
Other questions?
One more.
Please.
Yes, you mentioned how much input you had about the concern for compliance and enforcement. Do you feel that the rules as they stand now address that in a way that people can understand how both industry and local government and citizens can understand the compliance and enforcement process?
Catherine?
Mr. Chair, board members, as I mentioned, it's really a process that we have in place internally. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, that's a process that is it's very, very robust. They have our compliance enforcement folks have this whole big system that they go through for you know, determining the severity of violations and the consequences that I can't speak to because I don't work in that realm. So, and that's why we're not putting in this rule, but I think then going back to what board member Saxhug said, I think if we put this out, putting in some information about how that works is probably something that we should be doing
that
just
be
to
helpful.
Make it clear.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Other questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you very much. Let's then move to an update on DNR mine reclamation rule, and I'll ask Heather Ahrens to come forward. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you. Commissioner Fredrickson, members of the board, my name is Heather Ahrens. I work for the DNR as State Program Administrator Director, and I'm here to talk to you about the status of the reclamation rule. The goal of the rule, the goal today, it's a pretty big rule, so I will highlight some of the major concepts and objectives of the rule and to also speak to some of the contributions of interest of the panel and how that also was addressed in the rule. When you talk about reclamation, it's a common misunderstanding that reclamation is something that only happens at the very end of the lifespan of a mine. But in reality, reclamation starts before during mine planning, before the first scoop is ever taken. And so the reclamation rule and how Minnesota views reclamation is holistic. We look at it as something that occurs throughout the lifetime of the mine. So the rules reflect that as well. It has information that is required for a pre-mining assessment, as well as what's going to occur during the operation of the mine, as well as what are the plans for the mine as it for closure. The benefits of reclamation really benefit all stakeholders. In terms of the public, it allows a safe and sustainable and ensures a safe and sustainable land use. Operators, it offers statewide consistency and efficiency. And for the environment, one of the biggest objectives is to minimize disturbance through mine planning. For non-metallic mines, the oversight of mining, the permit to mine, as well as reclamation, is at the local level. Mine siting permit is controlled by statute or is listed in statute MN 394.25, and this continues. But the Department of Natural Resources was given a task to write reclamation rules. We do also have the additional task of providing an additional permit for the trout stream setback permit, but we still do not have necessarily the authority to give a permit to mine. So that, with that in mind, the reclamation rules was written for LGUs to implement. All three agencies had a request for comments at the same time back in July of 2013. And some of the comments that the DNR received in terms of the reclamation rule is just the level of engagement. There was a request for an advisory panel. There are environmental concerns associated with mining and sensitive areas, impacts to aquifers and sediment pond construction, and then interest about how administratively these would be addressed, or mines would be addressed administratively, for example, the need for corrective actions. And then there were also comments that administratively current laws are effective. And then there was strong interest in financial assurance. The first time that the DNR met with the panel was in May, which we did an overview. And similar to what Catherine spoke to, at the end of that meeting, an interest table was generated. The next meeting, we started to review rule language, and that was in August. I used NR 135, which is Wisconsin's reclamation rule for non-metallic mines, as a platform of discussion to weed out some interests and concerns, and also blended in some rules that we have for ferrous and non-ferrous mining. Throughout the course of the fall, we just tackled some of the major topics of the rule, which includes financial assurance, standards, what it's required in a reclamation plan, and then administratively, how do you go through the process of submitting a reclamation plan. In January, we talked specifically about blasting. And then in February, the full rule draft rule was delivered to the panel, and they were allowed a 45-day comment period to give suggestions and comments and feedback about what was developed throughout the panel process. During that time, we also did additional outreach. Actually, 15 counties and cities were visited and spoke to the staff of those counties. We looked at industry tours. We also talked to technical experts. I met with members of the citizens' organizations as well, talked to Wisconsin DNR as well as Wisconsin County administrators just to get a better background and understanding of how NR 135 works and what are the strengths and weaknesses of that, as well as just get a feel for the processes involved in mining silica sand. The current status of the draft language, there are four sections of the rule: general provisions, standards, and reclamation plan. The standards includes blasting standards. The reclamation plan includes financial assurance, language, and then administrative procedures. The rules are going to apply to new mines, and that is being defined as any mine requiring a first-time permit by a regulatory authority, or an existing mine that is requiring a new or amended permit to expand beyond its existing permitted boundaries, or if they have to have a permit to increase their production by 25%, or if they need a permit to change the geologic material, let's say going from limestone to sandstone. There are exemptions, and the exemptions are just to avoid including into the rule operations that weren't intended necessarily to be a mine but are excavating silica sand. For example, excavations under 2 acres that are being used by a farmer on this land. Construction, if people are excavating through with road construction, if there's an emergency and there's a need for material for floods or natural disasters, dredging, construction of drainage ditches, remediation of contaminated sites, and then finally, to avoid complications during a road construction project, if there's a borrow site, which is a temporary mine that quickly opens and is reclaimed, being overseen by the Department of Natural Resources, that would be excluded from the rule as well. In the standards section, there are performance standards that just general performance standards that apply. For example, the mines have to operate within all, you know, federal, state, and local laws. There's topsoil management provisions, grading and sloping, mineland water bodies. And then I just want to take a moment to talk about blasting standards. There have been concerns, you know, what does blasting have to do with reclamation? If you look at the precedent for reclamation rules, in the federal reclamation rules, there's blasting provisions, as well as within our own state for metallic mining and ferrous, non-ferrous mining, there are blasting provisions within the reclamation rules. And so we put blasting rules to address silica sand. I've been working with blasters as well as miners to figure out technically what is appropriate, and well as what are they used to. They've been self-regulating very well over the years, and so they've been using provisions from that have been established by the National Fire Protection Association. And so I want to include what they've been using to address some of the concerns for vibrations, and as well as to create a pre-mining blasting survey so that citizens who are next to mines have an opportunity to get surveyed if they want, you know, their structure at the cost of the mining company. Also, in the standards, there are intermittent mining. If an operation is going to be intermittently mining, that has to be addressed as well. For the reclamation plan, there are application requirements. One of the biggest concerns of that I heard were potential, impacts to neighbors, and if does financial assurance address that? And usually, that's a contract between the county or the administrative authority and the company. But I was able to address that concern by making sure that within the application requirements there's proof of insurance, and that they have to provide proof of insurance every year within an annual report. They have to address, a list of pre-mining conditions, what are the description of the mining activities, what's the post-mining land use. Like I said, there's going to be an annual reporting requirement. There's also revegetation requirements, and what is post-closure mine maintenance, as well as corrective actions. Some of the administrative processes is how do you submit a plan? What's the public notice requirements? How do you determine if a plan is approved or not? You know, processes for denial, modification, suspension, revocation. If there's a change in regular, you know, authority, and so on. One of the concerns that I want to make sure that apply to all mines is the right of inspection, so that the authorities can, you know, annually inspect mines, as well as blasting can, you know, is applied to all mines and not just new mines. Next steps, you know, you've seen, it's not much different from what you've seen previously, but I do want to highlight that I'm in the process of incorporating the written comments that I received from the panel. We're undergoing legal review, and I'm currently in hibernation for writing the SONAR, the Statement of Need and Reasonableness. There's additional information that the draft rule can be downloaded and looked at that you have on our website, as well as additional information about the rules. And if you have any questions, thank you.
Thank you, Heather. Eric. Predictable, Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess there are a lot of detailed questions or, you know, slash comments about language, mm-hmm. and I don't know if this is the best place to ask those line item, or if maybe just submitting written comments to Heather is better. I don't want to take up the public's time either, because, okay. you know, we're here to hear them. I guess one big question was, during some of the outreach that we had done earlier, I heard a lot of concern about dewatering of the mines and potential impacts to surrounding private wells. And in here, there was mention of, you know, creating groundwater contours, but I didn't see any reference to monitoring wells, mm-hmm. to actually monitor the water levels at the site boundaries, or, you know, kind of... I saw language that alluded to, you know, post elevations and that sort of thing, but I was wondering if that had come up, because I just remember that the groundwater was an issue, or, you know, a concern of some of the citizens. And
members, Commissioner Frederickson, that's a very, very good question. I worked really hard in making sure that I didn't duplicate existing regulatory provisions. For example, if they need a water permit and they are dewatering, if they meet the thresholds for a DNR water permit, the DNR water appropriation process would address that. And so I didn't want to necessarily duplicate, you know, that, as well as the stormwater. You know, if there's an excavation greater than an acre, they're going to need a PCA stormwater permit. So if there are provisions within that permit or processes within that permit and requirements, I didn't want to duplicate that as well.
Okay.
But there is a complicated, I think, not complicated, but there is a quilt of regulatory authority at the state level as well as the local level, and trying to make sure that this is efficient within that, you know, those framework was a goal.
Sure, I understand that and applaud that, leaving the duplication out. I guess there was the alternative requirement approvals.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it seemed like it might be kind of might fall under some of those, I forget which subpart. But
yeah, and you know, talking to Wisconsin, I wanted to make the rule flexible enough that if an LGU, if there wasn't dewatering and there's still issues of or water concerns, I feel that the LGU can still, you know, potentially require that as needed. But if they are dewatering and there are major hydrologic impacts, that would be appropriated through the DNR.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Other questions? Chris?
Heather, is there any quick way to explain how the rules, permits, and environmental review relate? because that's really confusing.
Sure, and that was that's a really good question. One of my goals was also to somewhat bridge environmental review into the permit. So there's environmental review, which is done before any governmental action is made. And I'm not an expert in this, but I've hung around the EQB a little bit enough to speak. There's environmental review is done before a permit is given, and then the permit and reclamation process plan would go hand in hand, that would be after environmental review has been completed, and then hopefully, you know, there's a little bit of wiggle room that it can be either the plan can be adopted separately from the permit or it can be adopted with the permit. And so there's, I think, like two stages, the environmental review stage and then the permitting phase. And depending on how an RGU wants to do it, they can weave in the reclamation plan or they could separate it out and adopt it separately from the permit.
Is there, Mr. Chair, is there an example of the hand-in-hand nature of the permit and reclamation?
Well, no, not at this stage because it hasn't, you know, this is new.
Just an inventive way. Yeah.
I think, I don't do permitting within the state agencies, but there are a number of additional permits. There's potentially a water appropriation, as I mentioned, and stormwater, and there are additional ones too if there's going to be impacts to fens and management plans. And usually that is done in step with the local government permits, and sometimes they will put in their permit, you know, upon approval from the DNR or upon approval from an agency. And so even if there's some outstanding issues, it does somehow wind back to the conditional use permit or interim use permit from the local unit of government.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair?
John?
Oh, Heather, how does silica sand mine reclamation differ from metallic mine reclamation?
Quite a bit. With metallic mining, there's a potential for the release of sulfates and sulfur in acid mine drainage. With silica sand mines, you don't have that issue, and so it's not as complex.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Seeing no further questions, thank you very much, Heather, for a really complete discussion. And at this point in time, we will move directly to public comment and Mr. Becken, to accommodate your schedule, put you on number one. Tim Becken from Gemstone and the Aggregate Ready Association. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for accommodating my schedule.
Oh, yeah.
Very much.
It'll cost you some point, you know.
I'm sure. So.
No.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. My name is Tim Becken. I'm with Semstone Products Company, and we are a sand and gravel construction materials mining and ready mix company, and we are based in Mendota Heights, Minnesota. And I'm a fourth generation. We've been at it for 88 years. So we have a long history of mining sand and gravel in the state of Minnesota, and I just wanted to speak just as a offshoot of, obviously I know this is silica sand mining, but just to connect the dots between what we're hearing and what we're seeing in the state in terms of connections between sand and gravel mining and silica sand mining. We are very familiar with EAWs and EISs. We just completed an EIS down in Rosemount, Minnesota. We are successfully, we're qualified, and we are mining on the University of Minnesota Umore Parkland. So it's 1,800 acres, and we'll be there for 40-plus years mining, you know, millions and millions of tons of sand and gravel. The sand and gravel, in that case, it was a very open public process with an EIS, and in that case, the U of M was the RGU because of their standing in the state. But we've also done other EISs, both within the state and within Empire Township. So we do truly understand those projects of that magnitude. What I'm here to speak about is on the other end of the spectrum. You know, sand and gravel, compared to silica sand, it's sold locally. We sell our product for most of the time. It can be well under $5 and $6 a ton sold. And the great consumer of our product tends to be units of government, both directly and indirectly, to build highways and bridges, so whether it be townships, counties, or MnDOT. And so our product is really generally sold within 20, 30, 40-mile radius. In fact, we don't sell our product outside of the state, essentially. And there are pits, essentially, in almost every county in Minnesota. So our concern becomes is outside of the metro area where we're very familiar with maybe large deposits. And the one I talked about at UMOR is kind of the last big sand and gravel deposit left in the Twin Cities because of both where the material is and then also because of that development has not occurred over that. But when you get to the outstate, most of the sand and gravel pits tend to be very small. In fact, many of them are owned by even townships and other units of government. And so they are very small, and they tend to be used for very local projects and for road gravel or just day-to-day use within both a township or a county. And so it's very typical that you could have a 40 to 80-acre parcel or a 100-acre parcel. And so when you talk about lowering the threshold of EISs so much lower, we really are concerned about that because we have seen already within counties that are affected by the silica sand where the counties in many cases are small enough where they do not want to have two regulations for the mining industry. And because there is confusion. And so ultimately you see them wanting to go to essentially the silica sand mine threshold even for what we would call a typical sand and gravel construction materials pit or mine. And that just becomes really economically unfeasible for those sites to exist in at all. And so our company, we were very active in working with Goodhue County in terms of working on their sand and gravel mining ordinance. And so you've seen them kind of already, you've seen this case example where we came up with a good sand and gravel mining plan, and it was been in effect for a couple of years, and essentially now it's all being scrapped because of this kind of rush to regulate the silica industry. And so we just have a real concerns with dropping some of these EIS standards in terms of acreages because of the linkage. Because we're just seeing counties that are unwilling to have two different ordinances. And so so it's a related industry, but it's also a very separate industry. So those are my comments. I appreciate, you know, you're willing to listen to me today and be happy to entertain any questions.
Mr. Becken, you're here on behalf of your company, but also are you here on behalf of the Aggregate and Ready-Mix Association?
Correct.
So you're speaking.
Really for both.
Okay.
As a member, yeah. But also I'm able to speak both to large facilities and to small ones that we operate in small towns or bigger cities. So.
Questions? If not, I'm sorry.
I have a quick one. Excuse me. Did you feel, Mr. Beck, that the definitions were clear in the rules? Did they to you make enough of a distinction between the silica sand materials and the aggregate? I know that's a challenging attempt.
That's kind of a loaded question, obviously. Being a part of the industry for all my life, you know, I kind of when you're kind of it's like everything. You kind of know the insider. Language or the rules, and so generally I would say yes, but where it becomes has the potential for becoming confusing is when you have a much broader audience and there's a lot more people with, you know, they just haven't been involved in the industry, and it really becomes a potential for a problem. So to answer your question, that way.
Thank you. And my follow up is there anything that you can think of that could be done, you know, at this level to support the local government willingness to distinguish between the two in their processes? Is there anything you can think of that would be helpful,
Mr. Beck?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I guess what I would say is I think it's very important from the state's level that we really support the adoption of if you're going to go down a path of really having separate ordinances and separate kind of requirements for the silica sand versus traditional construction sand and gravel. So I think really helping to support and really pushing both local units of government, whether it be counties or townships, to having at least a couple of different strategies in dealing with different industries. And then whether that includes even technical support at the state level, I think would be really judicious, because, again, most of the material that we produce is consumed by local units of government. And so if the small operations are unable to either come into existence or can no longer comply, it's us really as the taxpayers that are going to be bearing the cost of trucking that in from farther distances.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Becker, thank you very much. That's very helpful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim. We have 16 more folks, 17 more. I'd like to ask Mr. Roy House to come forward, please. Roy is from Fillmore County. And thank you for taking the time to come in today, Mr. House.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner and board members. I might just add that Fillmore County did develop two rules of regulations, one for aggregate and one for silica. And it wasn't that hard because the aggregate was pretty much left in place and the silica was what we worked on and changed and developed rules for. But what I'm here today for is just to remind you of the big picture that Southeast Minnesota is a remnant of America the Beautiful that's fast disappearing. So those of us that are here at this place and this time have an obligation to save it. So that's more or less what I would like to suggest, is that we develop an umbrella over all of these rules and regulations that limits the density of silica mining per township. And our suggestion has been that it be two per township. And in that way, you have a sort of an overall protection that helps with the underlying rules and regulations. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hollis. Any questions? If not, again, thank you. Mr. Croson, and then Kelly Stanage also come up and have a chair so we can move through. Thank you very much. Welcome, Mr. Croson.
Yes,
Mr.
Good afternoon.
Chatfield.
I'm also from Fillmore County in the Chatfield area, Bottom Mountain Township. In our township, we have four proposed mines already in place for silica mining, and that came about because we wrote an ordinance in Fillmore County in 2012, of which a number of us citizens were able to take part in, and we appreciated the opportunity to be a part of that, and our input was recognized, and we appreciated that. We also wanted to speak in that vein, like Mr. Hollis just said, of putting a restriction per township to have some controls over what could happen to us in the future. And that was not adopted by our county, but they did put a limit of 5 active mines in Fillmore County at one time. So we did appreciate that. Upon that adoption by the county commissioners, 4 of my neighbors processed into the zoning office and filled out their applications for their, you know, their next 4 mines, because we at that time had 1 active mine. There was only 4 open opportunities, and they were there that very day to sign up for that. I've been a lifetime resident of Pilot Mountain Township, going back a number of years, and I know the properties extremely well, and these 4 neighbors are on adjacent properties. You folks know what that means. Here's a farm, a barbed wire fence, another farm, a barbed wire fence. 4 of these side by side. So I see density as a huge issue in my immediate area. I'm concerned about that. Our region is very karst-oriented, you know, properties. And for example, also in my lifetime, you don't need my history, but I've hunted a lot of raccoon in my days, and these coon hounds will chase these raccoons to the bottom of these sinkholes where they find a hole large enough for the coon to disappear in. So how much water goes down a hole that's big enough for a raccoon to disappear? It's a very vulnerable area. I would like some consideration for our environment in behalf of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Crost. Questions for Mr. Crost? Seeing none, I'd like to also ask Lynn Schoen if Lynn could come up. Also, welcome, Kelly. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Fredrickson and members of the board. I do want to commend the agencies for including local governments and citizens on the silica sand rulemaking advisory panel. It's a step in the right direction. I'd like to focus my comments on the process that that panel took, which I took part in. It was my impression walking into this endeavor that the agencies would maintain a position of impartiality and a focus on the work to develop rules that would support their missions. It was a big red flag when one agency representative said to me, "You have to realize this is a political process." Throughout the process, a great deal of deference was shown toward industry, even to the extent of simply dismissing air quality science coming out of the public health arena in favor of air quality science funded by industry, without any apparent attempt to reconcile the stark differences in results and conclusions. One agency representative continues to parrot industry talking points such as, "Quartz is the most common element on Earth." While this may be true, it is utterly irrelevant to the task at hand. Quartz tends to be pretty benign when left in our aquifers to filter and purify our water. However, when our aquifers are dug up and carted about, literally by the millions of tons, you can and should expect unintended consequences. I continue to maintain Minnesota's agencies are influenced to a much greater degree by industry than by residents. I did some research on your missions. The EQB's mission is to lead Minnesota environmental policy by responding to key issues, providing appropriate review and coordination, serving as a public forum, and developing long-range strategies to enhance Minnesota's environmental quality. The PCA's mission is to protect and improve the environment and enhance human health. The DNR's mission is to work with citizens to conserve and manage the state's natural resources, to provide outdoor recreation opportunities, and to provide for commercial uses of natural resources in a way that creates a sustainable quality of life. Can you honestly say that these rules move you toward fulfilling your missions? The focus of agencies demonstrated throughout this process was one of compromise rather than a focus on your missions. These rules would serve to allow, measure, and control pollution and destruction of the land rather than to enhance, protect, improve, or conserve the environment, or to enhance human health, or to create a sustainable quality of life for Minnesota residents. This sort of institutional bias naturally develops as a function of the fact that agencies deal much, much more with industry representatives than with residents. It's very common to see this bias in such agencies. I do not contend, either, that corporations are intrinsically evil. We must recognize, however, that they have a fiduciary obligation to maximize profits for their shareholders. That is the core of their mission. When agencies allow far greater influence by industry than by those affected by them, you are allowing your missions to be compromised by their core purpose, which is to produce profits for their stakeholders. So how do we go about changing that? I did notice in the PCA's strategic plan, which was very good, by the way, an interest in embedding continuous improvement principles in the culture of the organization. One principle of continuous quality improvement is creating a continuous feedback loop. One way to do this would be to require that for every conversation your staff has with industry, they must have and document a conversation with someone affected by that industry. I will say that for the most part, I have enjoyed working with agency staff. I came to respect, if not their perspective, at least their intellect. An authentic focus on considering different perspectives by embedding a continuous feedback loop, which looks at all facets of an issue, will move you toward a greater level of impartiality, which will in turn promote a culture of commitment to the integrity and the pursuit of your missions. On a different note, but also related to process, these rules, which in my mind are weak, in large part leave it up to local governments to be enforced. There is little evidence that local governments are capable of, or in some cases even willing, to enforce them. During our panel meetings, this was discussed frequently, but the rules do not reflect the collaboration required among state agencies and local governments to see that rules are ultimately enforced. Don't get me wrong, I firmly believe that local control is essential to conserve and enhance the principles of local land use planning. However, the demand for frac sand, the scale of these operations, and the frenzy created by the potential profits have made this industry much more complex to manage. For example, regarding the 200 ton per day threshold for an air quality permit, who will weigh the trucks? Who will count the trucks? What will your agency do when this limit is exceeded? How will you even know it has been exceeded? What happens when local government does nothing about it? The result is that you are leaving it up to citizens to enforce your rules. This creates a situation where citizens are pitted against their local governments and against the industry. This has become, or is quickly becoming, a social justice issue. The front page, all you need to do to recognize this is to read the news. Front page of a La Crosse Tribune on Sunday, March 22nd, an unpermitted minefield, it says. These are all about Houston County, the county in which I live. Front page of the Star Tribune on Monday, March 30th, mining tension tears up county. Front page of the Winona Post on Wednesday, April 8th, Houston County zoning head sanctioned. These are not the only examples of this sort of thing. You can watch them happening daily in Wisconsin. So as you consider these rules, I encourage you to very carefully consider the following principles. Develop rules that are consistent with your missions. Take responsibility in collaboration with local governments for verifying compliance and for enforcement. And avoid placing the financial and legal burden of enforcement of your rules on residents of Minnesota. I thank you very much for the opportunity to address the board, and I'd be happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Stanich? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask also Marie Kovexi. I hope I pronounced that name correctly, Marie, or did I mess it up pretty bad?
Close. Kovexi.
Pardon me?
It's Kovexi. Close.
Okay. I'm sorry. Lynn.
Thank you very much, Chairman and members of the board, for allowing us to give you some thoughts. I was part of the Rulemaking Advisory Commission, and my name is Lynn Shane. I'm representing Wabasha, City of Wabasha. I had a couple comments, but first I wanted to address the Semstone person. From a local government perspective, we've actually been advised by our attorney in the League of Minnesota Cities not to break out silica sand and aggregate. And I personally felt that there was a need to, because a lot of us do have little pits all over the county, and a lot of our farmers use the sand and our streets departments, but we've been advised not to based on end use. And so there's already a conflict inherent in the way city government is being advised, which I don't know how you fix that, but it's what I'm trying to tell him is that he probably has more support than he's allowed to be given just because of the way we're being advised. Okay, what I wanted to talk about was the RGU and who should be the RGU. One of the things that I need to kind of give you a framework, I'm in a town of about 2,500 people. We service an area of about 10,000. That's why we have a Mayo clinic there, a number of dentists, a number of things going on, because our area is actually much larger. But one of the things about the environmental review that to me is key is that, and based a little bit on what Kelly said, was consistency. You're looking at, just in the time I've been on the city council, we've had two different groups contracted out to be our city planner. Now, we don't have a city planner or a planning department or anything of that nature. We went from a full-time city planner to a very part-time city planner, totally different agency. We have a part-time support staff for her. And so when you're talking about all of the things that go into a 60-day review, whether it's, I mean, it doesn't matter what the conditional use permits that come through, everything that comes through, her bed is full. And then we're dumping on, we're doing a conditional, or a, we're redoing our comprehensive plan. We're looking at downtown redevelopment. We're doing all kinds of these little side pockets, and she, quite frankly, isn't enough person. So when I'm looking at the environmental review, the one thing I want on an environmental review is consistency. I want to know that Lake City is being evaluated. At least you're checking off the same boxes we are in St. Charles and Rochester. You might have a few extra different boxes or less boxes, depending on the community, but at least you're consistently looking at the same things. And that's totally missed, even with just switching over to a new planning department, totally different training, bringing people up to speed on the history of a property, where we've been, where we're hoping to go. You know, that changes every 2 years based on what the board is elected. So every 2 years, the environment shifts depending on who's on our board. The one thing we need is a consistent review process. And, you know, I do believe that local planning and local zoning should be responsible for the permitting process. But when you're talking about an environmental review, I really think the state should be the RGU, because there is so much moving, so much turnover, so many different members, turnover in the city staff, turnover in the people that we contract for, and turnover on the board, the city board. There is constant turnover. I've never been at the same table with all of the same members because somebody's out sick, somebody's on vacation, somebody's, you know, there's never the same group there and anything can go. So at least if we have a consistent environmental review, I've got facts in front of me that I can count on. I know that you took your time, you did due diligence, you're looking at the same things. You don't have to reinvent the wheel every time because a lot of you that are working on environmental review through state agencies have a degree in it, you have history in it, you've done it before, you know what questions to ask. You don't have to retrain yourself every time you're coming on to a new engagement or a new anything new coming past the table. I spend a lot of time doing my own research because I don't know that the information I'm getting is complete. And even then, I'm only limited on what I don't know what I don't know. You know, and sometimes I get misinformation on purpose so that somebody gets what they want. Sometimes I get information, oops, we forgot to give you that. So there's a lot of local politics that isn't necessarily ethical, and it's nice
to
know.
You get that? I thought it was just
me. No, unfortunately. So I'd like to know that at least the environmental report I'm looking at has been a little bit politically removed, right? So the other thing is I think it's more financially prudent. I mean, if you've done a traffic study for one mine, you've got a chunk of it done. You don't have to redo it every time there's something else coming through. You have to tweak it. You have to update it. But a lot of it has already been done. And on environmental review, it doesn't stop at borders. It goes across borders. So you guys have a bigger picture as far as looking at cumulative impacts. So that what is happening in Red Wing, who's north of us, and Lake City, who's north of us, the Mississippi flows downhill, people. And so if there's going to be some water contamination or any concerns about that, Wabasha is going to get hit, and so are the people south of us, Winona. So what I'm saying is that for me to be reliable and consistent and accurate, to get information like that, for me to make those decisions, I need to have an agency overviewing this. It's a natural checks and balances, as you will, for the political arena. At least if we have our agencies as the RGU, we have some neutral information. Permitting, I think, should be local. But when you're talking environmental review, because of the scope of it, I think, you know, it's important to keep it neutral and intelligent, complete. The last comment I wanted to say, we had a meeting last week. I asked, we're looking at a gravel pit, how to make sure they don't become a silica sand mine. And this is what I asked. Who's establishing the baseline? Because our thing says, if you go over and above what you're doing, it's a current existing mine. They got grandfathered in, but not for future activity. Who is establishing that baseline? Who is enforcing it? Who is monitoring it? And everybody around our little semicircle looked at me like deer in the headlights. Nobody had a clear answer. We're not that big, you know? Somebody must have been assigned this. Nobody had an answer. And that's why people like me get really stressed out, because if I'm going to make a rule, it has to be an enforceable, and somebody has to be responsible. And I don't think it should be the taxpayers and the people that are living in my little city. Thank you so much for giving your time and attention to us. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Shane. Questions for Lynn?
Sorry.
Seeing none, again. Thank you very much, and thank you for serving on the committee. The check is in. The check is in the mail. The check is in the mail. I'd like to also ask Marilyn Bayer to please come on up, and at this time, Ms. Koveshi, right?
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you very much for your time this afternoon. I have remarks prepared as a local county commissioner in Winona County, and also I have a letter from our Director of Planning and Environmental Services, so I'd like to address both of those. I'm going to spend a little time going over the scope of the operations in Winona County, and particularly Winona City in part of my district. And I'm going to talk about a resolution the county just passed related to the rulemaking process, and then just summarize. So first of all, I have a map which shows there's actually 9 points on here in the city of Winona and in the surrounding area with frac sand operations. I think I have the dubious distinction of serving as a county commissioner with the most silica sand operations in my district. There are seven operating currently in my district. And these are not gravel pits. There's a blasting mine that has never been permitted. He's grandfathered in. My neighbor's window was broken when the mine was blasting twice a day, 4 and 5 days a week. So you can see some idea of the scope there. There are two washing and processing facilities, neither of which have been permitted. They're grandfathered in. And there are four transload operations. So you can see we're getting a lot of sand coming into Winona, into the city area of Winona, coming in from Wisconsin, coming in from Fillmore, coming in from Houston, whoever's operating around us. We have two mines operating currently in the full county. The county has a population of 51,000, and the city of Winona has roughly around 27,000. So that gives you some idea of the size and the complexities of our local governments. I would echo Lynn's comments. We are a rather small county. We're slightly larger than Wabasha County with some of our staff and some of our facilities. But that all of the points she was raising about people giving you incomplete information, about the importance of keeping information neutral and the process neutral, all of those things apply very strongly in our county also. Since most of these, the barge, we have four transload, three are truck to rail and one is a barge loading facility. He's permitted for 48 barges a month. It takes 60 truckloads to fill one barge. So you can do a little calculation there on the amount of truck traffic that's on our roads. In 2013, his throughput was over 200,000 tons, and in 2014, he was over 300,000 tons. And he also would like to expand. He withdrew his application to expand or his intention to expand when he realized because of his throughput he would have to do an environmental review. Winona County, with our regulations, we have been proactive. We did set a moratorium when the businesses first became apparent that they were wanting to operate in our area, and we saw what was happening in Wisconsin. The other thing that Winona County enacted, in addition to our standards, are that we have a road user fee for silica sand transport on county roads, and I think that's unique also in the state of Minnesota. Recently, as a county commissioner, our board did address some additional concerns, and we passed a resolution which structured three particular requests through the rulemaking process and through the legislation. First, we wanted to extend the provisions that are set to expire July 1st. Winona County does not want to be involved with discretionary EAWs, and our planning and environmental services director speaks to that point in his letter. We do not have the staff or the expertise. Leading into that, we feel very strongly that the local government unit should not be the RGU for any environmental reviews. That's a lot of alphabet in that sentence, but we do not have the staff numbers. We're a very minimal operating county. We have had zero levy increases in the past 3 years. We do not have expertise necessarily in the areas of hydrology, geology, air quality, reclamation, and all of the points. And in addition to what Lynn Shane was mentioning, we also would like consistency. We know that it doesn't exist just in Winona County, and there is some economy of scale to the state setting regulations, which would help us out. We rely on the EQB very much for technical assistance. We have used this document of tools to assist local governments in planning and regulating silica sand projects. We find that very helpful, even though they are at the status of recommendations. We feel that if the EQB could be named as the RGU, this would not affect local control. It would help us out because The permitting process obviously still occurs at the local level. Since we don't have the staff or the expertise to do an actual thorough scientific study, we would like that to be done on a consistent basis, and then we would use that careful information to help us make our local decision in the permitting process, and we feel that would be very helpful. The third point in our resolution was to set the threshold for an EIS at 40 acres in the karst area. We are in the midst of the karst area. It's a very sensitive area in terms of the interaction between groundwater, trout streams, all of those factors. And we feel that a 40-acre size is a sufficient size that would has the potential for environmental damage. So we would like to see the threshold for EIS at 40 acres in the karst area. I just would like to summarize by saying we have two strong points. We feel that the rules and the tools should be aligned and consistent. There are many recommendations in here. There's research, there's discussion, there's options listed for local governments, and then when you look at the rules, they don't necessarily match up with the recommendations. For instance, on page 33 in this document, it recommends air quality monitoring for mining, processing, and transload facilities for all processes, and that is not currently in the rules. We also feel that the karst area needs special protection due to the critical action, as I spoke about. And again, the tools booklet addresses this also, because the introductory chapter and throughout the booklet, there are many references to the reasons that the karst area is significantly different from other areas in the state. Those are my comments. I'd like to now read a short piece from Jason Gilman, our Director of Planning and Environmental Services. And he's saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, recently the County Board of Commissioners passed a resolution expressing support for the continuation of Statute 116C.991 with suggested improvements. This statute governing thresholds for environmental review of industrial sand mining is important to Winona County given our abundant resources and the desire for clarity on environmental review requirements." Speaking about the environmental review and the silica sand projects, that section specifies for some categories of silica sand project, a specific state agency will be the responsible governmental unit. We support that option, and we also support the option for the EQB to be designated as the RGU unless the local government requests it. Having been through an environmental assessment worksheet for a small 19.1-acre industrial sand mine site, we understand the burden on smaller local governments that lack staffing or other capacity to carry out environmental review of complex projects, while still providing meaningful results to inform the local government permitting decisions. In particular, we're dealing with a sizable new industry type, having largely untested history on our landscape in southeast Minnesota, given the potential intensity and proliferation of operations, including the cumulative impacts. Should the provisions in 116C.991 lapse before permanent provisions are adopted and in effect, and or local governments be the primary RGU for these complex projects, more burden will be placed on the county and advisory committees in making discretionary EAW determinations on silica sand facilities, potentially adversely affecting southeast Minnesota's environment and quality of life. And he closes by saying, "I believe the complexity of industrial sand mining issues, from air quality to karst topography and potential groundwater impacts, to the intensity of heavy trucks impacting our transportation system across state and county lines, warrant the EAW process be objectively and consistently applied across county boundaries by a consistent RGU preferably with a robust access to technicians and scientists in the areas mentioned above, both for the benefit of the industry investor who will rely on a predictable process for business planning and to the concerned public desiring widely accepted standards. And I thank you very much for your time and for your interest and for the chance to be here this afternoon. And if there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them now.
Thank you very much, Marie, and thank you for bringing a county commissioner perspective. It's important, and we're appreciative of you taking the time to be here. Are you able to leave any of the documents that you were?
Yes, I unfortunately don't have enough copies for everybody.
Oh, that's
but I have
fine.
One copy
for
of
the
each,
record.
And it, they can be.
Okay. Yeah. Questions for Ms. Kobeshi? I'm messing your name up again.
It's Hungarian. That's all right. It gets called all kinds of things. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I
please.
Wonder, this is kind of a technical question. Is a county able to establish a different threshold for EIS? She was saying that they would like to establish a threshold of 40 acres for in Karst area. Is that, do local governments, can they establish a different threshold?
Local, Mr. Chairman, we'll have to get back to you with the answer to that one, Kristen. My understanding is local governments can order discretionary review,
uh-huh.
but they cannot amend Chapter 4410 of administrative rules. So the mandatory categories are set by the EQB, and yeah.
That's clear. Thank you.
Welcome, Ms. Bayer. I also want to invite, and I'm struggling here, is it Shaner? From Winona, 1620 49th Avenue, Winona. Shower, all right. Sure, S-C-H-A-U-E-R, all right, now I see it, yeah. I apologize. I didn't say that.
It's true, I know it.
All right, and thank you. Please.
Chairman Fredrickson, ladies and gentlemen of the board, thank you for this opportunity to address the Environmental Quality Board on the proposed rules for the environmental review of frac sand facilities. My name is Marilyn Frown-Crown-Beyer, a land stewardship project member and a lifelong resident of Houston County. May I say congratulations for having your agencies come out of their silos, as Director Seifert said, and work together in this important endeavor. It is believed it was beneficial for all involved in this rulemaking. It was my privilege to serve as an alternate on the Minnesota Silica Sand Rulemaking Advisory Panel, and during participation in those meetings, it became clear, as the gentleman from Fillmore County stated and the Winona County Commissioner, provisions need to be included in the rules recognizing the sensitive nature of the karst area ecosystem of southeastern Minnesota and the impact industrial-scale frac sand mining would have on this region, which has been my family's home for the past 149 years. That sensitive nature of the karst area ecosystem in the Paleozoic Plateau was a clear driver of the legislative package passed during the 2013 legislative session. During said session, the standard put forth by the Department of Natural Resources, testified strongly for by the DNR Commissioner Landwehr, and supported by numerous others as well, to protect the cold water aquatic ecosystems in the Paleozoic Plateau was a hard setback of 1 mile from, quote, any spring, groundwater seepage area, fen, designated trout stream, class 2A water or as designated in the rules of the Pollution Control Agency, or any perennially flowing tributary of a designated trout stream or class 2A water, end quote. We propose mines falling within this clearly defined area require an environmental impact study, EIS, at 20 acres. And when disturbing 10 acres of forested or other naturally vegetated land in this Paleozoic Plateau ecosystem area, they require an environmental assessment worksheet, an EAW. Water protection is front and center with Governor Dayton backing current legislation designed to prevent pollution from entering the state's waters, an effort noted by the governor's office to, quote, be essential to the health of Minnesotans, the protection of our drinking water, and the long-term sustainability of our environment, end quote. Governor Dayton also stated, quote, people have the right to do and follow lawful practices on their private properties. However, they should not have the right to contaminate waters that all of us depend upon, End quote. Imagine that. Allow me to share with you an exchange which happened after the close of the final Minnesota Silica Sand Rulemaking Advisory Panel meeting. One of the gentlemen representing industry had mentioned during discussions he had recently moved to Minnesota from another state to take the job he now has. As goodbyes were being said, I went up to him to shake his hand and stated it was a pleasure to have met him, then said, "Welcome to Minnesota, the state with the number one quality of life in the nation." He smiled broadly and replied, "Thank you very much. After participating in this process, I can understand why." We both shared a laugh. Each of you, as members of this Environmental Quality Board, is greatly responsible for making Minnesota the number one state in the nation for quality of life and for helping keep our state's quality of life in its premier position. Too often in this day and age, the appearance is given, if not the reality seen by the public, of their state government agencies facilitating smooth sailing for extraction industries in their states, while discounting or outright ignoring, in some states, the level of damage those industries will be leaving their state's future generations to inherit. We have all heard it. They take the money and run, short-term profits for a few, long-term harm and devastation for the rest of us, especially our fragile ecosystems. We look at the drought in California, where no one had even had water meters until now, and to the southwest as they continue their massive drawdown of the Ogallala Aquifer to irrigate lands which never should have probably been planted in the first place, and shake our heads. Minnesotans have been proud in the past to say, this is not West Virginia, or Kentucky, or Texas, or North Dakota, and now Wisconsin, with rampant devastations to their environments brought about by the single focused pursuit of nothing but money. We like to say Minnesota is not like that. In this land of 10,000 lakes, we respect our environment. We do not do that here. Well, at least we hope not. We are indeed hoping, after participating in this process, the hard work, diligent research, and thoughtful, powerful points made by citizen representatives on the Minnesota Silica Sand Rulemaking Advisory Panel are indeed going to show up in the rules to help keep Minnesota ranking number one in quality of life in our nation, rather than their work being relegated to a footnote stating, citizen input was solicited. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to address the board and for your continued work and dedication and diligence to protecting this beautiful state, which we are privileged to call home for this generation and the generations of Minnesotans who will come after us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Beyer. Questions? If not, again, thank you very much. Mr. Schauer, and before, I'd like to invite Jim Gurley from Winona to come on up also. Mr. Schauer.
Thank you, and good afternoon. At this point in time, most of what I have to say is going to be repetitive, so I'm going to just make a real brief summary. My first and foremost concern is that in 2013, environmental review requirements were set for frac sand, and it was strengthened until July of this year. These rules are the ones that we're reviewing today, and I think it's pretty obvious how complex the issues are. It's understandable why the June-July deadline won't be met, but however, we need the 2013 requirements extended until these new permanent rules of environmental review are in place. This is critical to any action taken, or you leave a potential window open for another Wisconsin or worse. We need to act now before it sunsets. So my question to you is, what's going to happen between July of this year and until the rules are actually set? With regard to the rules themselves, there's 2 points I'd like to make. One being that the local RGU should come from the state agency, both due to personnel, time, experience, and consistency, all of which were mentioned earlier. And the last issue I'd like to address is reclamation. I don't know if anything was mentioned. If so, I may have missed it. About reclamation for existing facilities need to be required as a part of the plan as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schauer. I'll ask Will to address the question. I assume you want some kind of a response to it.
Yes.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. The answer to your question is the interim interim rules lapse on July 1, and yes. and then the rules for the current rules for non-metallic mining would apply until the rulemaking that we're proposing is made final.
Okay.
Other questions, comments? If not, Mr. Schauer, thank you very much. Welcome, Jim, but before I go to you, I'd like to ask, invite Mr. Harvey Benson from Harmony to come on up and take a chair.
Thank you, Commissioner, or Chairman Fredrickson, and
welcome.
Board, thank you. I live, as I have for the last 27 years, in Winona County, about 10 minutes out of the city of Winona. We, of course, have a well on our property, and we depend on that well to live. Last spring, there were companies that were on the property across the road from us doing some interesting excavation, and we wondered what it was. We found out later that they were drilling boreholes to test for sand. We also found out after the fact, much after the fact, that head executives from the Eagle Materials Corporation from Dallas had traveled to the township that's across the road from me and talked to the three leaders of that township board and told them that there was 50 to 60 years of frac sand there and that they intended to go into the side of the bluff and to mine it. And that they had, and we found out later that they had negotiated a letter of intent with the property owners that no other company would be allowed to, they would not allow any other company to mine the sand there. None of this was known to anyone. We heard it through the grapevine. We went to the township the next month, and the board told us they had no idea what the names were, the people that talked to them. They didn't know the specifics. They didn't take any notes. It's very disconcerting. The area I live in is an area where basic, plain-spoken people, most farmers, live. They're not necessarily political. They don't go to a lot of meetings and speak in on microphones. But shortly after we found out, we called a meeting, and 25 or 30 people showed up, which is amazing, given the scope and the scale of where I live, very few people. We have met several times, and we are engaged in trying to be proactive with this, although it's hard to fight something that doesn't exist because they haven't applied for a DNR permit, hydrological permit, at all, as far as we know. I say all this in preface to my concern about my well water, about my quality of life. I want all of you to be cognizant of the fact that with these rules, we're dealing with human beings. We're dealing with families. We're dealing with people like myself who chose this area of the world in southeast Minnesota to live precisely for the reasons that it is so vulnerable to things like mining. The quality of life, the delicate karst topography, the wonderful trout fishing, so many, many things, the beauty. And I just want to say that I hope that whatever you can do to make these rules as strict and as possible, please do it for our sake. We don't expect that there be strict, the same kind of strict restrictions for the other parts of Minnesota that aren't as vulnerable as the karst area. But for us, it's imperative that we keep a very, very strong hand if we're not going to ban this industry, which we should, in my opinion. If we're not going to do that, we need to have strict regulation of it. I would just, I don't have much to add to some of the eloquent comments that have been made so far. I would echo, though, that I do think a threshold of 40 acres is very reasonable for an EIS in our given our situation. The responsible government unit really needs to be a state agency. The local units of government down in southeast Minnesota, they don't have the expertise, the knowledge, the money, the staff to do a good job. And as someone said, our waterways don't respect political boundaries. We would definitely rely on a state agency to oversee the process of that environmental review. So I very much appreciate your time this afternoon to listen to us, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hurley. And questions for Jim? Seeing none, thanks again. I'd invite Mr. Reddy to come up and welcome Mr. Benson.
Good afternoon, friends. When you called my name, I almost didn't come up because these predecessors had so many good things to say.
There's the end of that story is that everything has been said, but everyone hasn't said
talking.
It yet, right? So we all have to say it,
you
right?
You always have P.S.'s.
Yes, okay. Absolutely. No, I'm glad you're here. Thank you.
Thank you for letting us be here. And I noticed somewhere on one of those charts it said what government and what was it? Citizens and industry and the citizens. Well, there were a lot of kind of experts here today, but Heather said that she was not an expert in this and this and this, and I think most of us are not experts in most things, but maybe we can be experts at being concerned citizens, and perhaps that's the only kind of expert I can be. So in that list of groupings, I guess I'm one of those citizens. And this whole procedure, all these things are so complicated that I can't follow them and the subject. So I don't even know what some of the people are talking about, but I'm still concerned. Somebody mentioned that there is a rush to regulate. Well, I'm kind of conservative, and I don't want to rush to regulate. It's kind of the idea that we have to get this done before something else happens. Well, that's a good idea. We all know that it's better to keep the barn door shut or keep the fences fixed before the animals escape, because after that, we have a heck of a mess. And very often this is the way things happen. We kind of look at the short term, and either we don't look at the long term or we don't know about it, don't realize it. So I think it's very okay to take a lot of time to get things right. And by getting things right, I mean ensuring the health of the people. And I think about air and water, and these are things that cross over all kinds of boundaries, and we know about problems with air and water all over the world today, and they're going to get worse. So I think we have the responsibility to do what we can in our area to keep that air and water as good as possible. There are all kinds of ideas of what should be done, but I believe there are a number of facts out there, and by spending more time getting more facts rather than just suppositions, it's a good idea. So take your time. I'm not in a rush. I might be pretty old, but that's okay. Thank you for letting me be here today.
Well, Mr. Benson, thank you, and I'm glad you chose to come up today and give us your perspective. It's extremely important. Thank you. I'd like to, before we go to Mr. Reddy, I'd like to ask Ms. Cowgill to come on up. Thank you. Mr. Reddy, nice to see you again.
Hi, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Thanks for having us up here today. My name's Vince Reddy. I live in near St. Charles. My house is right between the T and the C in that little brown spot on your map there. It's all brown, you notice. And you can look at the key for what that means. I'm a concerned citizen. I'm a member of the LSP Board of Directors, and I'm a retired nurse. When I sink a post hole to make a fence of my farm, I get frac sand down at the bottom. A lot of people would like to make waste of my farm just to get at that. I'd like to address first, there was a gentleman sitting here who had to leave in a hurry. And there were some misconceptions that I want to bring up. It's been chafing at me ever since. There are no 80-acre gravel pits in my township, nor are there any 80-acre gravel pits in any adjacent township. Also, the industry representative that was here earlier, I can't recall his name now, made the common mistake, I believe, of merging sand is sand. There's feldspar and sandstone and so on. Silica sand is different. Uranium and asbestos are not soil. They're different. Things that come under the ground are not all the same. The regulations that occurred in the past and that he was referring to refer to little sand pits. What we have in my township, we do have mining going on, and we do have gravel pits and mine pits. They're about 2 acres. You can come down and see them. They're run by my neighbors, and we use them to put on our roads and so on. The standards that we're talking about today, as they evolve from plain language and they become actual standards and move into legalese, I'd like to remind everybody of a couple things that are a concern to us in my township and in my region. I'm not speaking just as an individual. I have spoken with most of the voters in Saratoga Township about this process. We're the township that's all brown in this corner of Winona County here. As it moves along, the karst region isn't suited to strip mining, and that is pretty much common sense. If you come down and drive around the region and you're one of the visitors there, you're probably there to do trout fishing, cross-country skiing, camping, tourism, or maybe you're selling seed corn. But you're not there to eradicate a hill. That's a whole new industry. I'd like for the standards to consistently have a mandate that everybody within a mile of the activity as it progresses is notified. Originally, there was a blasting standard where they were going to notify people within a half a mile. And if you look at the way we are laid out, within a half a mile, you wouldn't have to tell anybody before you blast it. Within a mile, there's only going to be one or two neighbors, but I think we should know about what's going on. I'm talking about as it moves from proposition to review to permit to reclamation, blasting, and the operation of the mine. We would like to see no more than 5 acres open at any time. I've described to you the current activity. We have 2-acre gravel pits, maybe 5 acres. And I don't know where that figure of 80 acres ever came up, but I don't think any mine should be 80 acres open. We just can't. That's too much disruption of our landscape. I would like to see, all of us would like to see the size threshold for an EIS to be 40 acres rather than 80 acres. 80 acres is a tremendously large, when the average farm size is about 160 acres, that's a pretty big impact. Heather was talking about on the PowerPoint about cost-benefit analysis of the industry. And I think everybody's aware the cost-benefit analysis or risk versus benefits in medicine, they say the industry has a certain benefit they're looking for and there's a certain cost associated with it. I also have to look at a benefit of any activity that I see and what's the cost to me going to be. These will never be the same, and that's common sense. I want my quality of life to exist. I want my cows to be able to drink water, and I want the air to be clean, and I don't want a lot of blasting and disruption of my water table. The industry might have a different set of standards, and we're looking to you guys and everybody in the agencies at the state to mediate that and bring it together in a reasonable and fair way. I appreciate somebody had brought up earlier about the difference between metallic and non-metallic mining, and definitely we really appreciate folks knowing that the mining on the Iron Range is an entirely different animal, and the folks up there are supportive of it. The folks in my region in general do not support it. If you had a vote on it today, the industry just wouldn't exist. But because it is probably going to exist, we would like to see it regulated in a conscientious way, in a sensible way. I'd echo Kelly's comments and Marie's comments earlier. We would like also to see overseeing of the review process by a state agency, because we simply don't have the resources for it in my township or my county. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reddy. Are there any questions for Mr. Reddy? Seeing none, thank you again. I'd also like to invite Pat Barron to come on up, and I'll move then to Ms. Cowgill. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. I'd just like to speak to some of these regulations from the point of view of the city of Winona. Marie Cavesi has already presented some of the facts about this, our situation there. We do have seven or eight, depending how you think about it, facilities right in the city. I don't know how many people have been there, but Winona is kind of an island, and these are all right on, except for the mine, they are right on this island. And the sand that is brought in is coming across the bridge from Wisconsin, across the bridge into our town, to be processed and to be loaded. Those facilities have not been permitted. They've been grandfathered in. We have tried many times to figure out what the city means by grandfathered in. One place that I know is grandfathered in is, we were told that he has to follow the rules of any other business. That means, like, you know, noise concerns and things like that, but nothing specific to the issue of sand washing, sand processing, loading. When you see them loading this stuff, you know, in your tools book, mentioned that loading should be from the truck, should, you know, come from the bottom, should unload it down into the hole, and there should be a drop height of 8 inches. That is not what happens in Winona. What happens is trucks come in there, they pour out their sand, there's big piles of sand in all these facilities. The way of controlling the sand is to water it. And we have one guy in the entire city government who goes out with a little thing and sticks it in the sand pile to see if it's wet enough. All you have to see is to go down there while they're loading trains and stuff and see the people don't wear any respirators. There's all sorts of dust in the air. And so I would like to just suggest that, number one, we need very strict air monitoring, not just for the silica sand, but for the diesel particulates that are involved with all of these extra trucks, constant flow of trucks across the bridge and to these facilities. Also, those facilities are, because we're right on this little island, they are right next to, I mean, across the street from, residential areas. They are the whatever is in the air is going into people's backyards, into their furnace filters. There's a big museum there right next to one of the facilities where they have had to change their furnace filters frequently just because this industry is next door. We know that there's stuff in the air, and we really, really need help. The people who are on the city government,
you know, it's kind of an old boy situation where many people who are in the city government are friends with people who have been businessmen in the city for ever and ever. They all went to high school together. They are very reluctant to impose any kind of rule on these operations, and we really need that you guys will set the standards. They keep telling us, well, we'll wait and see what the state will do. We'll wait and see what the state will do. So let's have the state be really, really powerful, okay? The other thing I wanted to mention is that the idea of the rules and regulations running out on July 1st, and it may not seem to you like that would be a big deal or that anybody could take advantage of anything so fast, you know, in the time until you get the rules finalized. But we've seen that some of these operations, for example, CD Corporation that loads barges, that they are very willing to try to take advantage of such a lapse in the rules in order to expand their operation. And, you know, they are way over the two, as Marie said, they are way over the 200-ton loading level already that you propose, and they would be very happy to add some more barges, which they don't load through the bottom hole thing, but they load on a conveyor belt that goes way up in the air and then plops the sand down into the barge. I mean, come on. Finally, I know this isn't something that you can pass a regulation about, but when they have loaded the sand onto the railroad cars, those railroad cars sit along the tracks, huge, long railroad car things, uncovered. The sand is completely exposed. It can blow around at the slightest, you know, wind, and they sit there sometimes for weeks. They're just sitting there on the tracks. I understand that that's a federal regulatory problem, whether the trains are covered or not. But it is a really serious problem as well. So I guess that's all I really want to say. Everybody else has covered a lot more of these issues. But you really have to be in that place to see what the influence is of all of these facilities in one tiny little city. And it's pretty devastating. Oh, did you know, for example, that a local church in our town, which one of our colleagues is a member, received its insurance policy, and he was reading through its insurance policy for the year, and it specifically disallows coverage for anything to do with silica sand. Now, when the insurance companies are starting to disallow that, you know they think that there is a danger in this industry to the health of the people in, I mean, they're saying you are in danger going to church in your church. We're not covering you for silica sand. So please, we really need the most stringent air monitoring rules you can come up with.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cowgill. And questions? Thank you again. I'd like to invite Bonita Underbach to come on up, and let's go then to Pat Byron from Winona.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
LSB and yourself. Thank you for
and
being here.
Board members, appreciate the opportunity to share some comments with you. I'm coming from a little different perspective for the comments that were shared prior and probably those that are going to be shared after me. I'm a resident of Winona, have been for the last 4 years. My wife and I came back after being gone for 40 years when we went to college. I'm also a family member involved in a operation in South Central Minnesota, and that has a bearing on with my comments as well. But anyway, for the last 42 years, I've had the opportunity and the privilege to work with preschool all the way through high school students. And in light of this issue that's in front of us today, I often think, what will the future hold for these students? And I find myself taking a look at from the standpoint that, you know, we're on this earth for a finite time, all of us in this room, and all of us have an opportunity or need to take care of this planet and our resources in a prudent way. And what I'd like to share, too, with the students that I have, in light of this issue here with the air and the soil and the water, my kids, you know, the students that I have, some of them do have medical issues with respiratory. So silica sand particles, diesel emissions, eroded soil, having enough water to drink that's clean, and water in recreational areas that they can fish and swim is very important. And also the amount of water, because with the frack sand issue here, water consumption is quite huge. The comments that Mrs. Strainage and Ms. Kvesi and Ms. Shane presented here earlier, I really support all of that. Those are issues that I witness in committee meetings and board meetings and council meetings. And it's a very intense issue down in our part of the country in the Karst region. So please give due consideration as you make these rules and move forward with it. And also the citizen input into this and the rulemaking or the rules on this should be strengthened for the silica sand issue. And it's very important for consumers constituents to have input into this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Byron. Questions for Mr. Byron? Seeing none, thank you very much. I'd like to invite up Katie Amanga. And we'll go then to Ms. Underbach. Is it Bach or Bachy?
Underbache. Good afternoon. Chair Fredrickson and the board members. I was born and raised in Karst country of southeastern Minnesota and am fortunate enough to return to live the rest of my days there. It's reasonable to recognize the fragile permeability of our Karst region's geography. It is necessary for our state to protect the public welfare with strong rules for silica sand mining and processing. Industry cannot be realistically expected to regulate itself for public good. The rules for environmental review of silica sand facilities need to reflect the recommendations of the earlier tools to assist local government. And the temporary environmental review rules that expire in July 1st need to be extended. My neighbors and I need that from you, as best as you can. I know there's some difficulties, but you do have influence in that. And I support the eloquent comments that have been made by others before me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bonita. Are there questions for Bonita? Seeing none, thank you again. I'd like to also invite up Peter Larson and Brett Skillbred. You guys can one or both to have a chair. And let's go to Katie Haimanga.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and board members. My name is Katie Haimanga, and I was a citizen representative on the silica panel. I am a natural resources professional and a former mayor. And I'm just going to speak briefly to the importance of erring on the side of caution as you look at these rules and specifically related to reclamation. Industry would like you to adopt rules based on scientific research, and so would I. The problem here is that there hasn't been much scientific research in the area of land reclamation, and certainly in the area of land reclamation at this scale. There haven't been many studies. In fact, I'm not aware of any that are currently underway in Minnesota. One of my light bulb moments in considering reclamation was looking to the past and seeing what we were left with in our region from mining in the past. And I learned about Foster Aaron Park in Rochester, called a colleague of mine to find out what was it like to have as part of your park system an abandoned quarry. This one is along the Zumbro River. It's in the city of Rochester. And like so many mine properties, it has landed in public ownership. It is a very popular park. It was dewatered and mined, so now there is Foster Aaron Lake. It's one of their most expensive parks to operate. And they've had some challenging problems, especially with drownings. In that case, the high wall remains. You are more likely to drown in Minnesota in Foster Aaron Lake than you are in any other lake, with the exceptions of Minnetonka and Phelan. Is it because there is very little in the way of safe exits for the swimmers? Is it because the high wall remains and the steep sides encourage jumping? Is it because of the springs that make for a lot of variability in water temperature and cause swimmers to gasp as they hit those spots? It is unknown. And that is how we did it in the past, but not that distant a past. This was in our lifetimes. And now we know better, and we do things better. Or do we? What do we really know about restoring particularly the ecological functions of sites? In that case, a specific situation, the abandonment of mines and people drowned. What I'm concerned about more is how the failure to rehabilitate these sites well will impact people in the future in terms of water quality and quantity, supportive stream flow, and those sorts of things. We know now about the role that natural vegetation plays in the processes of cleaning water, of replenishing our aquifers, which support our municipal water systems, and so on. And we also know that there has been overreach, that human overreach has resulted in a landscape so manipulated that many of our natural resources no longer meet our needs for clean water. And you can just look to the condition of our lakes and streams across the state as an example of that. We in ecology, we've only been restoring prairies for 20 to 30 years. That's really not very long. It's not a long track record of experience, and it's not enough to know how to restore those other functions on the landscape that are so integral for the cleaning and the infiltration of water. We do know that it is easier to save landscapes and habitats that support human needs than it is to try to restore them once we've messed the situation up. Again, I encourage you to err on the side of caution, and additionally to encourage, by some means, scientific research in the area of reclamation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Iamunga. Are there questions for Katie? Seeing none, thank you again. And I'll again invite Peter to come on up to the table. Brett, nice to see you again.
Yeah, you too. Chair Fredrickson, members of the board, thanks for having us here today. Appreciate the time to listen to our comments. My name is Brett Skillbred. I'm here today representing Jordan Sands. We are the newest of the three permitted frac sand projects over the last 3 years. We are not new to mining. We're represented by a family in the Mankato area that's been in mining for over 100 years. I was also a member of the Silica Sand Advisory Panel, and I just want to take a brief moment to just give some of my perspectives on the panel and the time that we spent in discussion. Initially, the discussions were quite contentious, as I'm sure you can imagine. between the various stakeholders that were that comprised the panel. Over time, there was a lot of dialogue and a lot of education, a lot of questions for industry as to how we do things. How is this? How do your operations work? What are the standards that that exist today? How was the permitting process? What were the things that you had to do to get permitted? How about environmental review? What kind of scientific studies exist? And then lastly, you know, what are the best management practices that you employ as operators, and most particularly as operators that have substantial history in mining? We were able over time, at least in my opinion, and I'm not speaking for other members of the panel, to get to a place where there was general comfort with the industry members that were part of the panel. We were generally seen as being the good operators, and then there was discussion about the so-called bad operators, or those operators that have not yet come forth for permits. And this is where in lies our big concern, is that being a good operator, we're now being lumped together into a set of rules that are really being written more for the bad operators, or those that don't currently exist. And let me just give you one example of how this may go forward. In order to capture all of the very small operators that have been, that we've heard about today in the southeastern part of the state, there now exists a mandatory EAW category that will require us to restudy our entire project if we expand our mining area by 20 acres, which is roughly 10% of our current permitted reserve. So at the end of the day, we went through the entire permitting process, including environmental review, with pre-2013 existing rules, and there remains no concerns about protecting public health. Not only that, the LGU, our local LGU, which is the township, was the RGU for our environmental review. They received substantial input from agency, which was incorporated into the way our project was ultimately permitted. And I believe that this is the best way for these projects to come forth. And I also believe, having heard comments from our local township, that they want to have a seat at the table during the environmental review process. Each of these projects is very unique and requires very deep understanding of the local characteristics and concerns of each of the local communities in which these projects are being developed. I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Brett. Are there questions for Mr. Skilbred? If not, Peter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Peter Larson, Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I'm here with Minnesota Industrial Sand Council, and I'm here just to speak on behalf of the council on the rules that are being proposed, just going through them quickly. And then I wanted to talk a little bit more about the proposed mandatory category, particularly the EIS category, because that's a rule that will come before you as EQB members. We've had a significant amount of exchanges with the PCA. As Brett said, I would say that the biggest concern we have is proposed regulations that are designed on what might happen somewhere. The benefit the PCA has is that particulate matter has been regulated for a long time. So we're working through those rules with them. We've sent in significant comments. We brought in the air experts from Wink Engineering, from Bar Engineering, from Sunday Engineering, from Trinity Consulting, and we did that for a purpose, as we didn't want to have Brett or I, as much as we might know about things, to be the ones that were really talking with the professionals at the PCA. So we brought in the four air quality experts that have been working on all sorts of projects in all sorts of industries, and had them look at the rules, and we've submitted those comments. And we hope that people see those comments for what they are, and that's to get the right results, and do it in a way that doesn't overburden industry, and it's an emphasis on the right results. We have a lot of people who have a lot of experience in particulate matter control, which is what this is. There's nothing new about these particulates. And so we're working closely with the PCA on that, and we look forward to the rulemaking. On reclamation, we really want to give credit to Heather and her crew. She has an interesting situation, because there aren't reclamation rules statewide in Minnesota. There are mandatory categories for non-metallic mining. There are air rules for particulate matter, there are not reclamation rules. And we want to commend her. I think her rules are generally very well accepted by a lot of folks. We've got a few comments, and we're looking forward to working those through with her. I did want to talk a little bit about the EQB and the mandatory categories. I hope you'll look closely at those. There's certainly a lot of interest here in what's happening in people's neighborhoods. And it's kind of tough to sit back there and not both feel sympathetic and feel a little bit accused of something when we have to come up here and speak on behalf of the industry. So I want to make very clear that we are in favor of environmental review that's needed. We are in favor of environmental assessment worksheets if local governments or state agencies want them. We are in favor of EISs if they're needed after an EAW. There are mandatory categories in place already. We supported the mandatory categories that the legislature proposed and adopted. And so I just want to make sure as I talk through these things that we support environmental review because it's a good process. I have many times in my professional career convinced people to do a voluntary EAW because there was a situation where there were several environmental issues that local people were concerned about, and it was the best way to gather them all in one place, have a government agency in charge of them, take public comments, and develop a document. So I'm going to talk about environmental review, but I just want to make it clear that this is not intended to reduce necessary environmental review. And with our clients and our association, we're probably going to do EAWs. I think if you look at some of your mandatory EAW categories, you're really virtually prohibiting development in some ways. And I think you should look at those to make sure that you're creating mandatory categories because intrinsically it doesn't matter how a project is designed. The project that's described in that mandatory category should have to do EAW. And you should make sure it's for permitting purposes, not to prohibit some activity. And I think if you look at some of those, you might see that you're getting pretty close to just straight out prohibiting some activity, and I'm not sure that's what you wanted to do. But for the mandatory EIS, the two comments I think that you should take most to heart are the Semstone comment and the comment that a lawyer has told local government that you can't treat differently a project based on the end use of its product. That's the right legal advice to give to a local government. And you might not get sued because someone doesn't want to sue you, but it's not because they couldn't win. If decisions are being made not based on what's happening on the ground, but who you're selling your product to. And so talking about the mandatory category, I know you have this in your packet, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of history. The legislature in 2013 considered a mandatory EIS and rejected it. In the process, there was a discussion of if there's not going to be a mandatory EIS, what should be in the EAW to make sure that people have the right information to determine whether an EIS should be required. And this is in your packet under the EQB update. But we went through this, and with some of your agencies, we did this, including Commissioner Stein, who's not here. But we went through this list with state agency folks, legislative staff, senators, and representatives, and we said there should be a hydrogeologic investigation because that's the groundwater issue. You need that information to determine whether there should be an EIS. There should be a groundwater appropriation. If there's a groundwater appropriation permit, there should be an assessment of water resources. So that's the groundwater availability issue. We said there should be an EAW provision in there for that. For air quality, there should be an air quality impact assessment. So that's in here. There's a traffic impact analysis that has to be part of an EAW for a silica sand project. There has to be an assessment of the project's compatibility with other existing uses. You've heard a lot about whether that use is someone who lives nearby or some other use. And then specifically, there has to be an assessment of mitigation measures. And those provisions were put in law, and they aren't what's going to be going away now with these mandatory categories July 1st. These are in rule right now, and the purpose of those was to make sure as a substitute for a mandatory EIS, which the legislature decided not to do, this gives everybody the information they need to decide whether there needs to be an EIS. And I could go through more things. Commissioner Landwehr is very familiar with the trout stream permit requirements. those requirements were discussed with Commissioner Landwehr's staff to make sure that if something was happening near a trout stream, you didn't even need an EAW to get the information that local governments needed. That's a very specific set of requirements, and you can look at the DNR guidelines. I've got it here if you wanted to talk about it. There's DNR appropriation permits, PCA discharge permits. If there's land issues, by the time the rulemaking is done, there's going to be a statewide reclamation rule. By the time the PCA gets done, there's going to be a silica-specific air quality rule. And there's local zoning. On the air side, I handed something out, and I just gave that to you. I don't know, you don't want to discuss the details of air quality permitting right now. But, you know, if someone's concerned about environmental review for particulate matter, environmental review is supposed to, in many ways, fill holes. You know, the Department of Health has set a chronic standard that everybody has accepted based on the California standard. This is an analysis of hundreds of monitoring data points over a year in Wisconsin, and this type of work continues. So you don't need an EIS to do this kind of work. It's being done right now. So an environmental study of this type of work on a particular project isn't needed because it's being done independent of an EIS. So I wanted to say all that just because it's quite a thing for the EQB to set a new mandatory EIS category. There is a category for 160 acres or more. I want to clear up something that was said before. That is for the entire project. It's not 80 acres or 40 acres or 100 acres open. Nobody wants to have more open than they need to for operational purposes. That's the entire project. By setting a mandatory category lower than you have right now, this is what I believe you're going to get as a dynamic. People want to avoid EISs. That's just a fact. If you have a mandatory category that's a reasonable category, and you've said for a long time non-metallic mining, 160 acres is a reasonable category, people will work very closely with the EAW RGU to make sure that everything's satisfied. There's no reason to do an EIS. If you get low enough that people are just going to have to do an EIS, you will lose, I'm telling you, you will lose that dynamic completely. People will do a scoping EAW, and they will move right to an EIS, and the regulators will actually lose the leverage they have to work through some of the issues that would clarify things so an EIS isn't required. EIS has killed projects, and maybe that's a goal, and maybe that's not right, but EIS has killed projects, and they should be reserved for the time that a local government unit or a state agency believe they're really needed. And we look forward to submitting additional comments to the EQB on those proposed rules. So thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Well, are there questions for Mr. Larson or Mr. Skilbred? Follow-up?
Mr. Chair, could I just say one more thing to Member Ed Tolleson? You asked when reclamation rules were being discussed, the interaction with permits. Mm-hmm. And I think what you'd find is that's a local government CUP interaction. Most of that work relates to land use and a desire to have that land be properly reclaimed so it's useful. And you will not usually see that interacting with state permits. You'll see that as a local government CUP kind of interaction. So I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks to both of you for being here. Mr. Bobby King from Land Stewardship Project. And would Rita Ledoux find her way up to the table, please. Welcome, Mr. King.
Thank you, Chair Fredrickson and members. I'm passing out Land Stewardship Project's comments, and a lot of them have been made, so I can skip a lot of it. I just mention it in passing and give a little more detail on the stuff that hasn't come up yet. First, I wanted to say that I participated as an alternate in the silica sand rulemaking advisory process, and rulemakings, It's cumbersome, and it's often done without opportunity for a lot of public input at this stage. And we feel like the process did allow for the public to see what was going on and to understand the thinking as it was developed. It was very useful, and we encourage agencies to use this model as they go forward. I want to say also that the MPCA, DNR, and EQB staff have sought out Land Stewardship Project's input, recognizing our expertise and interest, and we appreciate their time. One thing I've heard stated a few times is that the legislature rejected an EIS category. I was at the legislature. I never saw that happen. I never saw there be an official rejection of creating a mandatory category different from what's existing for aggregate mines. What the legislature did was say, we want the EQB to develop rules and come up with a proposal. So I don't think there's anywhere on the record where the legislature rejected lowering the standard. In fact, they asked the EQB to examine and come up with a standard for environmental review, which includes, obviously, thresholds, maybe the most important piece of what of environmental review. The first bullet point on here under environmental review is we do support these thresholds of 20 acres for an EAW and 80 for an EIS as a minimum standard. We, in fact, think those are generous and that in some situations they should be lower. I want to say we do have some concerns about expansion issues. You could end up doing an EAW for a 20-acre mine, expand by 19, expand by 19, and expand by 19, and now you're at just below 80, and you've only done an EAW on that one smaller first project. The issue that was talked about Jordan Sands having to do an additional EAW after having done an EIS. What we want to do with these rules is to create a process where it really becomes incumbent upon the proposer to be completely honest about how big they would like to get one day. And let's get it done all up front. Having rules that trigger EAWs during that expansion phase, I think, would help get it all out on the table so we just do this thing all at once. The next piece on here is about some tougher standards in the Paleozoic Plateau, and Marilyn from Crown Buyer covered that, and I won't go into detail, but obviously we feel that's very important. This third bullet point I don't think has been spoken to very much. Processing and transfer facilities are especially a large processing facility not associated with a mine, is going to be a real hub for mine development, and it's going to drive traffic is obviously going to come to it. It's going to have a huge impact on a region, and we think there needs to be an EIS category for that, and we actually believe all processing facilities and transfer facilities should have an EAW, and the EAW threshold here is more appropriate as an EIS threshold. But for sure we need an EIS threshold for that category just because one large processing facility is going to have a huge economic impact, a huge environmental impact on a region. I think that's unquestionable. The next bullet point is who is the RGU? And I want to make it clear that doing environmental review is totally separate from local control. The permitting is frozen during environmental review. We strongly support local land use, and the local permitting will stay untouched. But we do believe in many cases having the state expertise lead the environmental review is going to be better, and you've heard testimony on the capacity issues local governments have. Some local governments do have the capacity and have a track record, and we believe they should be able to petition the EQB and be the RGU if they want and they can demonstrate the capacity. But we don't ensure, in many cases, that it's done by the state agencies, the environmental review won't be adequate and then can't facilitate the permitting process and make an informed decision about the permit as it should be used. We've already addressed this fifth bullet point of the additional requirements for the EAW of frac sand facilities, that those, my understanding is, actually are in play now. The EQB had the power to just go ahead and incorporate those. I would encourage the EQB, though, to get up on their website like we have for feedlots, an alternative EAW form, so it's clear to citizens, the industry, and the local units of government moving into an EAW, you do have additional requirements and what they are. On the issue of air quality permits, this, in my experience, air and water quality are among some of the strongest concerns, and we strongly support the ambient air quality fence line monitoring. Neighbors are concerned about how this is going to impact their air quality, and the only way to do that is to monitor at the property line, what's leaving the property. We also think every frac sand facility should require a individual permit. Because this is a new industry, because we don't know how it's going to impact air quality yet, we need to err on the side of caution. The individual permit gives the agency a lot of discretion to impose individual requirements on a case-by-case basis as needed. It also requires public notice and allows for better public participation on an issue that people are obviously very concerned about. The other issue is, in an earlier version of the rules, what I think we'll be calling the plain language rules, there was proposed requirements to enclose piles, processing, that they would have to be within enclosures. We really like this. And being on the advisory committee, I thought it was pretty the citizens and I think many of the town local government folks like that too. And I think the best way to ensure that a facility operates in a way that doesn't pollute ambient air quality is to build it that way, not rely just on management practices, but build it so that this fugitive dust can't escape. And enclosing it is obviously the best way to do that. We heard testimony already about a transloading facility in Winona, right in the middle of a neighborhood, that's just a pile of frac sand and a front-end loader putting it on train cars. That silica dust is going into everybody's home. The last issue on here is reclamation. We believe that as much as possible, the reclamation plan should be designed to restore the ecological function of the landscape. That's not always going to be possible, but we should keep that in mind. There are on lines 366 and 381 of the proposed rules, there's a pretty detailed list of ownership disclosure. We strongly support that. We think knowing who owns and controls the mine is important to understanding how real the promise of reclamation is and their ability to pay for it. we've proposed a cash reclamation bond, but for sure what we need is a reclamation bond that's easily accessible to the local unit of government, that they're given deference. If they say they need it, they get it. If they think the mine operator is not following the plan, and we want reclamation plans as much as possible to be ongoing and the reclaiming as they go and to limiting a footprint. We propose 5 acres, so that ensures that reclamation is happening, that the mining doesn't happen, the company leaves town and leaves a pit. Things are happening, reclamation is happening as it go. We also would like to ensure that the reclamation plans are a part of the environmental review documents. You know, how a mine plans to restore the landscape is definitely something folks want to know about up front. And for it to be a part of an EAW and an EIS, we think would be helpful and necessary. And that I know this is difficult, but it's proposed that these reclamation plans apply to all facilities, but we do believe existing facilities should have to come into compliance. It's especially important in the city of Winona, where you have mines operating now that began with almost no regulation. That's, I think, summarizes our comments and gives some detail on what wasn't already covered.
Thank you very much, Bobby. Are there questions for Mr. King? Seeing none, thank you. I'd like to invite Aaron Scott to come up and join Ms. Ledoux at the table. And Ms. Ledoux, welcome. You're from Karst Country.
I am from Karst Country, from beautiful southeastern Minnesota, and from the tropical sector of the state. and I am a plain-speaking farmer. I have not followed every detail. My farm is in a little valley in the southeastern part of the country where we do not have internet. We do not have a cell phone that I can rely on unless I go 2 miles away to the top of a hill in order to get reception. So things are changing, I know, in the world, but so if my comments aren't quite as up-to-date as a lot of the other speakers here, know that my concern is just as much as what you've heard from others here today. At one time, I worked for the National Water Quality Labs in Duluth, Minnesota. This was in the time of the reserve mining case and the pollution of Lake Superior. And I only bring that up because we had a terrific director of that National Water Quality Labs. And one of the times he spoke to the lab and to the public in general at the University of Minnesota up at Duluth there, he was speaking about not only Lake Superior and Lake Baikal in Russia and comparing them, but he also made a comparison with the other water reserves in the world. And he said southeastern Minnesota is probably one of the largest reserves of water in the world. He said, for example, he said, you can take all the Great Lakes and put their water together, and you can take all the surface waters of the state of Minnesota and lump it into it. And he said, you still will not have the amount of groundwater that's present within the southeastern Minnesota region. And I subsequent to that, I have asked the DNR, you know, how much is really here? And I get the answer, well, we don't really know, but we think it's a lot. And as a plain-speaking farmer today, I want to just ask you a question or two, or in your mind anyway. Don't expect a reply as of this moment, but I know from Pilot Mound Township when we were down at the county, when the county did its public hearings, that the moment that the limit was put for what Fillmore County was going to allow for the number density of frac sand mines, that very quickly that limit was filled like bingo. I heard today in testimony from some of the other presenters here about the hundreds of thousands of tons that are going through the port of Winona on an annual basis, and maybe even more frequently than that. And I stopped to think of, in Fillmore County and in most of southeastern Minnesota, we can drill a well just about anywhere and get good water. That's not true all over the state. The southeastern part of the state is in Karst country, as you well know. In fact, my mailing address is Fountain, Minnesota. Fountain, Minnesota is recognized as the sinkhole capital of the world. So we do have differing topography. We have different hydrogeological formations there. A lot of these sinkholes are known to feed springs. Some of the springs disappear, go underground. You've proposed special regulations for proximity to trout streams. A lot of these sinkholes feed directly into trout streams, yet I don't see anything in your proposed regulations about distances from these sinkholes. And yet it would seem to me that this would be an important thing. But if you also think about all the people who want to mine sand and the amount of sand being extracted, what's going to hold the water in the southeastern part of the state? Are we going to end up eventually like California, because now our sand has been extracted and there's no place for that water to be? And the other thing is, not all the water in southeastern Minnesota is potable water. We have virtually one aquifer that I'm aware of that serves most of the southeastern farms in there and most of the southeastern states or cities within that sector of the state. Some of our cities down there, and the number is growing. Minnesota Department of Health can fill you in on the numbers and the details and the locations. But we, the deeper they go, the more the radioactivity is there, and the standards for drinking water are exceeded in many of our small towns. So we are virtually working with the the one aquifer down there, and if that aquifer that's one of the closer ones to the surface also is a major aquifer for the metro region up here, I understand. But if that gets jeopardized through the fact of pollution through sinkholes via streams, trout streams or whatever, it's a resource lost. And once a resource is lost, you're just not going to reclaim it. I also would like to address one thing about regulation, that the regulation being done at the state level is something that my county commissioners requested that the state do when Minnesota Sands was proposing its EIS, that they felt that they really wanted the state with the expertise to do that. They are volunteer farmers. A lot of them, you know, don't have the background that you state officials do, and really feel that if the resource is going to be protected, it needs to be protected by somebody who knows what they're doing. That you just can't have somebody say, oh, I like my neighbor, he's got a sand mine, and my, I just want to help out my neighbor or whatever. So I would advocate that. And the other thing is Minnesota Sands, or one of the other testifiers here, talked about that an EAW and a hydrological survey would abrogate the need for an EIS in a lot of circumstances. I would take you back to the base of what kind of hydrological investigation or survey is going to be done. And to be thorough, it's going to take a long period of time. I would not be so worried about if an EIS is going to prevent an industry from becoming established. You've probably guessed from my comments that I really question in some cases whether it's even wise for that industry to become established. And I think your job would be a lot easier if you could put in separate regulations or take the southeastern sector of the karst country out of contention because of its uniqueness and because of its valuable resources, and regulate the industry in the other parts of the state. Or if you must have one size fits all, then I think you really need to go for strict regulations. And I want to thank you once again, and I know a lot of you, or at least some of you, have heard me when you came down to St. Charles to get public input, and I appreciate that part, too, of your job that you've done.
Well, thank you, and thank you for taking the time to be here. Questions for Ms. Ledoux? Seeing none, thank you again. Aaron, you have the distinction of being the last voice.
Oh, fantastic. Well, good afternoon, late afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the board. My name is Aaron Scott, and I'm currently an area manager for Fairmount Santrol. Fairmount owns and operates an industrial sand mine, a sand processing facility, and rail loadout here in Shakopee. I was also a member of the Silica Sand Rulemaking Advisory Panel and have served on that panel over the course of this last year. As you know, that advisory panel was formed to provide input to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the State Department of Natural Resources, and to the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board regarding new regulations applicable to silica sand mining operations in the state. The panel had citizen members, members from local units of governments, and members from the industrial sand mining industry. And I'd also like to take the time and thank all the state agencies and their professionalism throughout that process. They had a tough task at hand, as well as the members that did sit in on that. Fairmount is a well-established, highly experienced mining company that has been mining and processing sand for decades. In addition to our mine and processing facility in Shakopee, we also operate a number of sand mines and related processing facilities in western Wisconsin, as well as other areas in the Midwest and even throughout the U.S. and southern areas of the United States. We're proud of our strong environmental stewardship and our experience in managing an important natural resource. We're also committed to the continuous improvement on issues related to the environmental impact that our industry has. In fact, it is a key part of our operating philosophy that we continuously look for ways to reduce our environmental footprint, ensure the protection of air and water resources, the health and safety of our workers, and our neighbors in the communities where we operate. We have engaged in many programs, whether it's the state or United States programs, for responsible mining practices such as wildlife habitat council, saving birds through habitat, wildlife at work, corporate lands for learning, ISO certifications, which also state a solid management system, as well as green tier. In fact, we're the first mining company to achieve the green tier status. These are things Fairmount is committed to at the Shakopee, Minnesota facility as well. And another added value presence with us being here at Shakopee is the creation of jobs through indirect and direct services, as well as local and state revenue. In 2014 alone, we paid just shy of $500,000 in local property tax and ag tax. Shakopee Sand appreciates the opportunity to work with the State Agency of Minnesota regulatory agencies on the draft and the rulemaking process. Although we have focused our comments on changes within those drafts, some of the proposed rules have highlighted the need of the industry, us, to better understand the department's evolving regulatory approach to non-metallic mining, or in this case, sand mining. Throughout the draft rulemaking, whether it's opinion gathering surveys being sent to specific areas in the state exclusively, or the examples of definitions and actual rules, it appears a state is singling out a specific industry rather than regulating a process or a use. A concern that I have is that the agencies may be overreaching some of those direction missions enacted by the legislation in 2013. For example, and I'll just kind of go through, a lot of these were already discussed by the agencies with concerns that some of us had in industry, but the DNR, the legislation specified that the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall adopt rules pertaining to the reclamation of silica sand mines, the inclusion of blasting standards, as well as the requirements for company structure, environmental compliance records, et cetera, is not covered by that scope or purpose of the draft document, and more importantly, may not be consistent with the enabling legislation. Another example, the MPCA was given legislation to develop rules to control particulate emissions from silica sand projects, both mining and processing facilities. The inclusion in draft rule to require noise sources or conduct fence line air monitoring of particulates and silica is beyond, which I feel is beyond the scope as well, especially considering that there's a great number of scientific data available from those facilities, from our facilities, that show that fence line monitoring is unnecessary, not to mention costly, with no value-added data being gained. The EQB has also been working on triggering thresholds and sending surveys to specific areas within Minnesota, which may look as if the state, again, is regulating a specific industry rather than regulating a process or a use. The area target is where specific grain size, roundness of silica may be found in Minnesota. Silica is abundant in many other areas. It may be round, maybe subangular. It's found in different size gradations. We operate facilities in other areas which we mine lakeshore sand, which is used in many other applications such as foundry and water filtration devices, large municipalities, wastewater treatment plants. Along with that, we also have mining facilities among the shores of the Great Lakes. I believe most of the representation on the silica sand panel was from those areas as well as the survey going out. Other Minnesota counties would not be represented, which I believe was not the intent of the draft process. Additional stakeholders such as other non-metallic mines in Minnesota may also not be represented. Other mines have shown interest in pursuing sand deposits, and they would be able to offer great comments as they would have a full understanding of the current permitting process. Stakeholders such as businesses who utilize silica for their process is another. Foundry, glass, water filtration, recreation, a lot of INR, construction, geothermal are all industries that are customers that our industry provides to. And in fact, Fairmount locally here in Minnesota sells to some of the largest foundries here in Minnesota, as well as construction markets such as roofing shingles, PGA Tour sand, if we have any golfers in the room, and that's just to name a few. One of my customers in my region takes just shy of 500 tons a day for glass sand, and that glass is a float glass company that also sends material to Minnesota, to some of the largest window manufacturers in Minnesota. And that same sand that I am giving to those guys is also the same sand that I sell into, for instance, a construction market, or the same material that goes also into the oil and gas industry. I think that those additional stakeholders would have a concern and be able to weigh in on some of this rulemaking process ultimately, because they have concerns about logistics, storage, and raw material cost. These are just to name a few industries many sand operations provide for. Just this week, I was talking to an old neighbor of mine, and through small talk, you know, he asked me what I've been doing these days and what my profession is, and of course I had to tell him, you know, I work at a sand mine. And he's a finishing contractor, and he said, "Sand? Oh, well, we use a lot of sand. We get it by the pallets, but it's bagged." And I said, "Well, what do you use it for?" And he says, "Well, we sprinkle it on our concrete, on wood finishes. It gets painted on. And that material is used as a safety device or a safety device for traction control and provides traction." You know, I stated, "Well, we also bag sand for that industry, some of the same material that goes into many other industries." But I did have to end the conversation when I found out is the bag sand was coming from a competitor of ours and not our facility. So, the proposed rules do appear to remove significant flexibility for a permittee to operate and leave leave permit application determinations wide open to agency interpretation. The overall nature of those proposed draft rules imply that a large number of sites would fall under the category or could fall under the category of an individual specific permit. It would also be the best interest of all parties to provide a general rule that would apply to all sites, keeping in mind that site-specific concerns can be addressed at the local level. Many of these new provisions as well, and the need to pull sand out of non-metallic mining, impose additional regulatory requirements which are based on fear and concerns rather than facts and science. We ask the department to provide the scientific information which supports the need for these proposed additional requirements and rules. Members of the silica sand panel have been operating in Minnesota or neighboring states for decades without experiencing negative impacts these new regulation provisions are designed to prevent. In light of this, we would also like to ask the departments to further investigate reasonings on why such regulations should be imposed on silica sand or non-metallic mining operations. Given Fairmont's experience and strong commitment to sound environmental practices, we are very pleased to have a seat at the table and be part of the advisory panel's work in examining proposed regulations. We also recognize the importance of appropriate regulation. Mining is among the most heavily regulated uses and industries, and we do not object to that regulation, provided that it is clear, predictable in its application, and most importantly, that it is based on science, not on fear or misinformation. Fear should not be the form of basis of policy or regulatory decisions. There's been some interesting discussions throughout the course and my time being on the panel, and it was helpful to hear from the many different perspectives from the various panel members. However, with all due respect to everyone involved, many of the comments made may not have been based on sound science, but many of those comments appear to be based on misinformation, including the fabric of current regulation and where and how the current regulation is addressed. The goal of the rulemaking process should not be to limit sand mining as an industrial lawful use, but to address legitimate impacts. For example, our Shakopee mine and processing facility, we have conducted an ambient air monitoring program, which involves sampling for particulate matter and crystalline silica. Data can be found on the MPCA's website. The data present is strong evidence that our facility has had no impact on ambient air and proves that current regulation is working. This data also comes at a cost. Shakopee, just over the last 3 years that we've been doing this monitoring and some of the other monitoring requirements that we have, has added up to over $500,000 in cost, and that data present doesn't state any negative impacts. And the data that's shown at Shakopee isn't unique. The same types of results have been obtained from other Minnesota facilities, as well as a comprehensive study that was conducted that we were a part of in the state of Wisconsin. The conclusion is that we have reached that this is based on science and actual data from studies, that the current regulation now are clearly adequate to address potential impacts of our industry. The time I spent on the sand panel, I also heard from many people who have concerns about our industry. However, they stated numerous times that they're not concerned with Fairmount or any other the other established companies that were on the panel. But they did say they had concerns with other operators. Again, I heard this at the sand mining hearing recently, the testimony that was given there. The same words came out that we don't have a problem with anybody in this room, but there's other operators out there. So in other words, that's telling me there isn't a need for more stringent regulation, but instead a need for enforcement of the rules that are already in place. Any new regulations that are specific to industrial sand should take into account that current regulations are working, and any changes must be based on careful consideration of the facts and the science. Otherwise, additional regulations would only give concerned citizens a false sense that the state is doing something. Those regulations may do little, if anything, to protect the environment, but impose substantial additional burdens on the industry with no corresponding benefit. So, again, enforcement.
Mr. Scott, I respectfully ask you to summarize your final comments.
In conclusion, as a responsible operator, we understand the importance of going above and beyond regulation in order to protect the environment. And we would also like to continue the discussion that we've had with the different departments and the state agencies in ways that our facility can seek regulatory certainty, as well as continue to offer scientific data. Working together, I think we can have a better understanding. Thank you for the opportunity today to address the board. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being here. Questions for Mr. Scott? Seeing none, thank you again.
Thanks.
With that concludes the public comment portion. Any questions or comments from members of the subcommittee? Seeing none, a motion to adjourn is in order. There is a motion. Is there a second? There is a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carried. Thank you all.